brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the program. Lots of things to get to, lots of things to talk about, lots going on around the world. I want to thank you for being here. Amazing night tonight. I'm telling you, we've got workers from across the country. Nissan worker going to be here talking about what's going on down in Canton, Mississippi, as the workers there at the Nissan plant are saying, you know what, we want to have a voice on the job. We want to have a say. We want better wages, better hours, better conditions. More importantly, some of the horror stories that I have heard, wow. And, you know, the sad reality is we've allowed a lot of this stuff to go on, not just in the South, but all across the country, under the guise of, well, you gotta be happy you got a job. Well, you know what? That only goes so far. When you're broken, when your body is broken, when you lose the ability to support your family, I don't know that that's really, really much solace. So we're going to talk to the Nissan worker. Also going to talk to a worker from Memphis, Tennessee, about the Kellogg greed campaign that's going on right now. They've passed 150 days now being kicked to the curb as the very profitable Kellogg Corporation, the cornflake people, Tony the Tiger, has kicked their workers to the curb. Why? Because they have the audacity to say that they would like some job security, that they're not going to allow themselves to be put at the whim of the corporation. And you know, well, gee, that's just too much to ask, isn't it? Also going to talk with Pennsylvania State Senator Mike Stack about his run for lieutenant governor, also a piece of legislation he recently proposed to take that black mark of minor marijuana convictions off of people's records. You know, because I know a couple of people who, you know, 18, 19 years old, they got caught with, you know, just a little bit, and bang, that's on their record. And in this day and age, stuff sticks with you. So it'll be interesting to talk about that. You know, because I tell my daughter this all the time. As she's growing to that age, I say, you know, make lots of mistakes. Just don't make ones that are going to follow you on into the future. Do dumb things, because you're going to. You're young. You're going to do dumb stuff. Just don't do dumb stuff that is going to follow you for the rest of your life. So we'll talk about that. And in the third hour, you know, we've been hearing this number 350. Parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and you know, that's kind of the tipping point to where things get really bad. In fact, you know, there's a whole group, 350.org, that's talking about climate change and all this stuff. Well, evidently, we've blown right on by 350 parts per million carbon dioxide in our, right up to 400. We'll talk about what that means. Is it too late? Do we now just go, screw it, there's nothing we can do? We're going to all be baked like bad potatoes until everything is ended. And if it's not too late, what can we do and what should we be doing? We'll talk about that. Also, your thoughts, your comments, your questions, whatever's on your mind, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. The big news today, don't know if you saw it, for all of you Obamacare haters, the number of people like you and me who have signed up for Obamacare has exceeded 6 million. So they've now got to the 6 million mark. Now, originally, by the end of this month, they had wanted 7 million. According to the CBO, in order for this to work the way it was supposed to, the projection had to be 7 million by the end of the open enrollment period. But, you know, you had those technical glitches. And, of course, we've had, like, what, 3,000 repeal votes? We've had the Republicans and Governor Manchins across the state, much like Pennsylvania, doing everything they could possibly do to block people's access to getting to those exchanges. Here in Pennsylvania, we didn't set one up. Said, fine, you go use the federal one. Had we had the states with buy-in, and had they been doing what they were supposed to be doing, we would, I think, exceeded the 7 million. Now, there's still a chance. There's a couple of days left. The way things have been going, there's some optimism that, look, you know, the reality is, and I think most people are this way, you wait to the last minute. You gave it a shot early on. The bugs were there. You said, you know, I'll wait till they fix it, and then they're going to come back. And this is kind of what they're hoping. Because it was just like a week and a half ago, they were at 5 million, and bang, here we are, 6 million. with still a couple of days to go. So it'll be interesting to see. Now, understand, they've opened they've let the enrollment period extend a little bit, as long as you said, hey, I was trying. You know, I tried, I went, and it didn't work, and I'm in the process. And the Republicans are losing their minds. And I got to be honest, this, again, another one of those moments in our history where Republicans are on the wrong side. Conservatives are on the wrong side. The ideological center-right, be it Democratic center-right or Republican center-right, the center-right of this country has fundamentally been wrong on every working-class issue since the Great Depression. They have actually, many of their center-right ideas caused the Great Depression. But here we are. Looking at this again, this health care that I look much like Medicare as. At the beginning, everyone was against it. All the Republicans were against it. Some voted for it. Not many, though. They were against it. They fought against it. The corporate special interests hated it. The doctors hated it. Everybody was against it. But the people kept pushing it, kept improving it. Now you try and take Medicare from my grandmother, she will literally beat you with her cane. And that's the way it should be. And you go back and you look at the Bush rollout of the poison pill to destroy Medicare, the prescription Part D, where we don't negotiate for price, Rick. We pay full price. We're Americans, damn it. We pay full price with full profit. They had the same thing. When their initial goal, they only hit 70% of their initial goal for the first enrollment period. So I would argue that the Obamacare, well beyond what the George W. Bush Medicare Part D brought around. And it's going to, I think, again, be much more successful as we move forward. Now, as I said, they're gonna let this open up, till, I think, through the middle or through the end of April to give people the ability to complete their enrollment, which I think is a good thing. Now, the part that I find interesting, and mark my words, mark it down on a calendar, put it wherever you have to. But the Republicans, this is their undoing. This is going to harm them. And it should, because, again, on the wrong side. And, you know, I take you back to, all, you know, I hope he fails. You know, you look at someone like John Boehner, who told CNN that, well, you know, it's above all, the report is a symbol of the failure of the president's health care law. It is a rolling calamity that must be scrapped. This was, you know, before the first enrollment ever happened, before anything went on. You get the beginnings of this. It's all scrapped the whole thing. And then when it came out, you know, you had Majority Leader Eric Cantor saying, well, stunning, just another example in another day in the series of mess-ups in Obamacare. Remember, 6 million people have signed up for it. Then you got the people who wanted to minimize the early numbers. People like Ted Cruz or Pennsylvania Congressman Tom Marino or Arkansas Republican Tom Cotton, who they likened it to athletic events. In Cruz's case, he said, you know, 106,185 people enrolled in Obamacare. He said 108,713 attended the 2010 NBA All-Star Game. And that's a reason to repeal it in his mind. And the same thing with Marino and Cotton. They said, oh, you know, our college stadiums are bigger. Marino said Obamacare enrollees can fit inside Beaver Stadium comfortably. Oh, you're so funny. So funny. And I wonder which one of these two, three idiots got the idea first. Because Tom Cotton, the Republican from Arkansas, said only 27,000 signed up for Obamacare using the federal insurance website. Not enough to fill Razorback Stadium. Aha, showed you. He actually knows the name of the stadium where his state's college team plays. Good for him. And you go down the list, and, you know, whether it's Chuck Grassley, the Republican from Iowa, you know, basically the same thing. The administration will limp along with this pitiful sign-up process. Pitiful. 6 million people. House Majority Whip Kevin McCarthy called the number staggeringly low. And you could just go down the list. I mean, whether it's ISO or, you know, Senator Pat Roberts from Kansas or any of these, all of the statements, Obamacare is a failure. It's horrible. It's a waste of money. It's a waste of time. And all of this minimalizing. And, you know, look, I've met several people who they are thankful that they've got an opportunity to get health care. They are eternally grateful that, you know what? If they get sick, they're not homeless. If they get sick, they're not destitute. And for me, that's what this is about. While the Obamacare is not what I wanted, and it's not what I think ultimately healthcare in this country is going to look like, it is a step in the right direction, because the reality is, before this came along, we had 50 million people uninsured. We had over a third of our population underinsured. And, you know, all of these voices, well, they canceled my plan. I wanted to keep my plan. And Obama said I couldn't. Obamacare took it away. You know what? Nobody seemed to bother to mention that the crummy plan that you had, had you gotten sick, had something happened to you, you would have had problems. You would have probably gone bankrupt. You would have probably lost everything you've ever worked for. And what's really scary is that there are those voices out there who will take this health care away from these folks and not have a second thought about it. And as I sit back and I watch the shenanigans, as I sit back and I watch Tom Corbett refuse to expand Medicaid, and I watch all of these players for purely political reasons, purely ideological, my side, my team reasons, go after and attempt to destroy this. You've got to look at the underlying rationale. This is not about caring if people get health care. This is, they lost. And purely and simply, what they understand is that, much like Medicare and their hatred of that, once people take ownership of this, once people get the health insurance, once they have that card in their wallet, once they go to the doctor and realize that preventative screening is now something that they can access, that their lives are going to be better, you're never going to get away from them. And they know that. Michelle Bachmann said it on the House floor. We got to take it. If we don't get it now, we'll never get it from them. And that, to me, is a good thing. So as you watch this game unfold, and, you know, Daryl Issa said the only tool, the best tool they have is to shame Obama. Really? Is that the best you can do? You can't come up with alternative policy? We're just going to shame and blame? And the answer is, yeah, that's about it. That's all they've got. Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. Working people, come to talk.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Newark airport workers are sick and tired of poverty wages as airlines there ignore the New York, New Jersey Port Authority's directive to raise wages by $1 an hour on the way to a minimum of $10.10 an hour. Kevin Brown is a vice president with SEIU 32BJ.
Anybody know who Jeff Smyzik is? He's the president and CEO of United Airlines. He earns more in 1 hour than the workers who clean his airports, his airplanes, in 3 months.
audio in this story, courtesy of New York City's Labor Press. The United Steelworkers are applauding a World Trade Organization decision calling on China to end tight controls on exports of rare earth minerals. The United Steelworkers say that China's manipulation of the supplies of these critical manufacturing materials has cost the U.S. many good jobs and is hurting the U.S. alternative and renewable energy sectors as well. Action on this stemmed from a complaint filed by the USW under Section 301. Of U.S. trade law, the union filed the complaint against what it says is a broad range of Chinese predatory and protectionist policies that are harming U.S. workers and the American economy. Rap music business mogul Sean Diddy Combs has some encouraging words for Nissan workers in Mississippi struggling to form a union and get a voice on the job. The workers are allied with the civil rights movement to overcome anti-union actions by Nissan. In a video addressed to Nissan workers who are having an event in Mississippi, Combs said standing up for workers' rights is important, especially in Mississippi.
Workers' rights are civil rights, particularly in the U.S., in the South particularly, where Mississippi has a history of the rights of people being disregarded. And history teaches us that the only way to achieve justice is to stand up for our rights. I'm proud to stand with Nissan's workers who have the right to not be intimidated or threatened.
Two unions representing federal workers, AFGE and NTEU, say that a House bill to give federal workers a 3.3% raise is a welcome and needed step to get federal pay back on track. The Fair Compensation Act is sponsored by Democrat Virginia U.S. Representatives Gerald Connolly and James Moran and Democratic Representative Elijah Cummings of Maryland. The unions say federal worker pay didn't cause the budget deficit and federal workers have already sacrificed enough with multi-year pay freezes while the cost of living keeps rising. The freezes amounted to $138 billion in lost wages, which means $138 billion less in money being spent in the general economy. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
And finally, we don't have unions in South Carolina. I wear heels, and it's not for a fashion statement. It's because we kick, and we kick those unions hard, and they will not step foot in the state of South Carolina.
I love about that clip. You know, you've got a government official saying that we're going to usurp the ability of our workers and the people in our state to exercise their rights. The person who says, I'm going to uphold the Constitution, is telling the Walmart shareholders, we're going to kick those workers right where it hurts with my pointy toe shoes. Wow. I mean, that is just mind-blowing to me. But I guess it is the South Carolina political mentality. It is not the Southern worker mentality, as we've been led to believe over the years. And the reality is workers are workers. I don't care where you are in this country. You should have the right to a decent wage. You should have the right to come home in the condition that you went to work in good, safe, clean environments. And you should have the right not to be harassed and intimidated. But the sad reality, folks, is what we keep seeing each and every day across this country is moving us back to 100 years ago. And you look at 110 years ago today, Mother Jones was kicked out of Colorado because she was stirring up striking workers there in Colorado. We're going back to it, and we had better stand up, we had better fight, and we had better stand together right now, or we're going to head back to those days, which is why I'm so glad to see that there is organizing going on, especially in the South, with Volkswagen in Tennessee, and now with this campaign going on at Nissan in Canton, Mississippi, where the state of Mississippi gave Nissan a boatload of cash. And I'm sure the promise that they would remain union-free, but fortunately the workers have put up with just about enough. And what do I always say? There's only so much of you-know-what people are willing to eat. Well, we're going to find out, which is why I've asked Ramil Nash. He's one of the Nissan workers there at the Canton, Mississippi Nissan plant. Ramil, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you. How you doing?
I am good. Tell me, you know, you look at this... all of this stuff going on across the country to deny people their right to association, to deny people their right to organize, to collectively bargain for better wages, hours, and conditions. I got to ask you, what's going on there in Canton, Mississippi?
Pretty much the same thing. You know, when we started, you know, saying that planting these signs, you know, everybody was happy, you know, saying they catered to every need, you know. And after that 5 years was up, you know, we started to lose benefits. You know, they started to hire in temp workers. And now things have changed a whole lot from the first time we started. And Now we just want to change.
Now, I understand, you know, much like in Tennessee, where the state of Tennessee gave Volkswagen $1 billion, the state of Mississippi gave $1.3 billion to Nissan to build that plant there with the expectation that there would be good, solid, middle-class wage jobs there and economic growth. I got to ask you, has that been the reality?
Yes, there have been a reality, and it was kind of sad that what happened to Volkswagen. And with Bob Corker and the governor there, you know, they kind of intimidated workers right at the end because they made promises to, you know, San Toyota that they wouldn't organize. So the thing is, we need to make sure that they're not violating, you know, their civil rights. And that's what's happening in Mississippi. We want to make sure that our governor is open and make sure that he's not violating our civil rights because we have a right to organize, you know, even though it's a right to work state.
Yeah, I find it interesting that your General Assembly has pushed through a couple of really anti-worker, anti-association pieces of legislation, much like they're trying to do here in Pennsylvania, making co-workers talking to each other, stalking here in Pennsylvania and I guess Mississippi as well, right?
Yes, those bills that they passed, tried to pass those three bills, and they try to limit the right to organize. They're pretty much what it is. You know, they're trying to limit car checks with one of the bills. They're trying to stop picketing in front of businesses and another bill. And also they're trying to make sure that if, you know, they get a building built or they're trying to decide what type of workers they can have there, whether they be union, non-union, to build a plan and to work in a plan. It's just all kind of bills that really designed to violate our civil rights, really.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show here with Ramil Nash. He is a Nissan worker at the Canton, Mississippi plant. The website that they have right now is dobetternissan.org. We've got a link at therickSmithShow.com. Just click on Ramil's name. It'll take you right there. Tell me, what are the conditions inside the plant? I mean, we're part of the reason people organize, part of the reason people want to join unions is for better wages, better hours, and from what I heard recently, better conditions. So tell me, what are the conditions there in the plant?
Well, more and more, you know, we having issues like safety issues, for instance. You know, you'll have someone to get hurt on the job. They'll get them rehabilitated for the most part, and a lot of times they'll put them back on that same job. And also we have what they call temp workers. You know, we're supposed to have a little small percentage of temp workers there. And these temp workers are, you know, they're good people. I talk to them every day. And really they want the same opportunity that we have.
Sure.
They want to have the right to be full-time at Nissan, you know. And it hurts them just as much as it hurts us. And they're afraid, and we got a lot of intimidation and things going on. A lot of people don't understand we have the right to organize, even in a right-to-work state. So we're trying to make sure we're trying to get people educated on that. And it's just a lot of fear, you know. Yeah. A lot of people just don't want to organize because they're just afraid, and they don't understand the scope of what's going on.
You know, it seems to me, Ramil, that we're reliving history. Last summer, we took a labor history tour across this country, the People's Tour for America. If you want to check it out, peoplestourforamerica.com is the site where we went through. We went to places like Kansas City. We went to places like Detroit, to the different auto plants. And the stories that we heard were much the same. Intimidation, unsafe working conditions, lots of temporary employees. In fact, the guy in Kansas City told me that, you know, back in the 40s, you know, the 20s, 30s, 40s, they would have 10,000 people standing outside the plant during the Depression waiting for someone to get fired or waiting for someone to get hurt so that they could get that foot in the door. And the employer loved that because everybody was on edge and nobody would ever question anything. And I see us going, sadly, back to those days. So as you see these temp workers coming in mass, because, look, you're right, they do want an opportunity, as we all do. But as you see the company being allowed to use temporary workers en masse, that does nothing but destroy the conditions for everybody else, correct?
That's right. That's right. And the things that that kind of bother us the most is we have our legislators and everything always talking about the middle class, and we are the middle class. But you always break down the barriers that allow us to become better middle class people. And the union is that form. You know, the union allows you to collaborate with the company, help the company be successful, and also help the workers be successful. And I understand they got that wage gap in between the rich and the poor, and we're just trying to close that gap.
Yep.
And we just want that same right. People in Mississippi, we got some of the best workers in the world. It's just our culture, it's our history. And we just want to use our abilities to work and make sure that everybody having a chance to be successful. We want the company to be successful. We want them to be successful. We want the people to be successful also. We don't want all the decisions made on one side. You know, we want both parties ready to come together like they do overseas in Japan.
Right.
You know, they're organized everywhere else except for in Tennessee and Mississippi.
That's interesting.
And I know they made a lot of promises, but these promises, like I said, not going to be met because the people in Tennessee and Mississippi are tired. And we just want to have that same right that everybody else have at Nissan. And I don't talk to Japanese workers, Brazil workers, Australian workers. I don't met with them. I don't ate with them. And they really don't understand what's going on. And they more and more, they understand, they more support us more and more. And we just need this movement to carry us to where we can have that right for us to organize. We really need this. And it's passionate to me and it's passionate to a lot of my coworkers and it's passionate to the temp workers. And we are tired of being intimidated. We're tired of being scared. You know, a lot of us, we want to work. We want to come to work and be safe. But a lot of times they're not allowing us to do that in a, you know, in the form and fashion where it should be. You know, let's talk, let's sit down and negotiate. And I promise you, they will be one of the top businesses in the world. And they will make just as much money as any other automobile place. You know, everybody has a chance to be successful.
Yeah. You know, what I find interesting in the state, in what you said is, whether it's Brazilian workers or Australian workers or Japanese workers, what all working people need to understand is an injury to one is an injury to all. If they allow you to be exploited and work in horrible or bad conditions or whatever, eventually it's going to affect them as well. So, you know, everybody has an interest in everybody doing well, I think.
Yes, they should have an interest in that because, like I said, they always talk about our wages. We get a fair wage in Mississippi and all. That's great. That's fine. But why not share the decision-making with the people that does the work every day? You know, we build 7 vehicles, you know what I'm saying, in that plant. One of a few plants in the world that does that. Maybe the only plant that does that. So we have the skill level to be able to do whatever they need us to do. We just need that partnership to make sure they were able to do that job effectively. We want the safety to be, you know, a part of our everyday conversation with Nissan. You know, they have things that go on, but we need that solid foundation with that union so that we can make sure our voices are really heard. You know, we really need that.
Yeah, I'm with you. You listen to the Rick Smith Show here with Ramil Nash, Nissan worker at the Canton, Mississippi plant. Website, dobetternissan.org. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Ramil's name. It'll take you right there. You know, one of the things that caught my attention that I thought was really interesting in Tennessee with the Volkswagen workers. Volkswagen really did, in my view, from looking afar, stay neutral. They stayed out of it. They allowed the workers to decide. Now, it was the political class. It was our billionaire class through their front groups and their bought and paid for shill groups who intimidated and put pressure on people. In what's going on in Canton, Mississippi, are you feeling the intimidation that a lot of workers in the U.S. feel from their employer? Is Nissan really putting the clamps down on you guys? And what kind of intimidation are you feeling?
Well, what's really going on, you know, a lot of times, like when it first started, they made us watch anti-union videos. They started that a few years ago.
Yeah.
And as we started to grow momentum and everything, they kind of backed up off that, and they had people coming on television that was anti-union start to wear anti-union T-shirts. If we want a union, move back to Detroit, you know. And the thing that bothers me most, and I think a lot of us and a lot of people there in Mississippi, is just not educated on what a union really represents. And I think the culture of the state, you know, is just, hey, you go to work, you do your job, you go home, and you do what they tell you to do. And a lot of people just believe that over the years that we've been there. And now people starting to get more educated and understand what's going on. The momentum is rising, you know, but the thing is the fear is still there.
Right.
Because people don't feel comfortable, you know, saying being a part of something this big. But I'm trying to make people understand that this is worldwide. The world is watching Mississippi. It's not just localized right there in Canton, Mississippi. We have the support of the whole country. We have support of actors. We have support singers, representatives all around the world. And we're trying to get our people to understand at work that this is a thing that we can do together. and Nissan can be successful. And Japan is neutral. Japan, you know, usually, you know, kind of let us handle these things ourselves. We're just trying to make sure that the state of Mississippi support its own workers. If they want the middle class to grow, you know, we got to be the ones to help grow with them. You know, that's the only way the middle class is going to grow, but that's all they ever talk about, our representatives. But they steady take away legislation that allow us to advance ourselves. Everybody's not going to be a lawyer, a judge, you know what I'm saying, a rapper, an actor. You know, we're going to have regular people in the world.
Yep.
And we need to make sure those people have a decent living, have a decent pension. You know, we need to make sure they have that. That's all we're asking for, just an opportunity.
Uh-huh.
You know, we're not trying to take it from anybody. You know, we want everybody to be successful.
Yeah, you want to be properly compensated for the work that you do. And if you're creating wealth, you want to share in it. That, to me, just seems like common sense.
Yes, it is common sense. You know, that's the issue. You know, you make money, you're successful, our pension, our benefits should match that wealth. Our economy is strong. Our economy is stronger now than it ever been before in history. And a lot of companies complain and say, well, they don't know what the health care is going to be. They don't know how the economy is going to be, this and that, but they steady piling in the money. And the thing is, they're allowing people to do 3 jobs, 4 jobs to compensate for 1 job, and people not getting compensated for their work. And we're just trying to close that gap. That's all we're trying to do. And the people want it, but we just got to eliminate that fear and intimidation.
Yeah.
And our civil rights, we feel like, are being violated sometimes because we shouldn't have to go to work feeling like, okay, we the next one in line for something to happen. You know, if they knew they had an atmosphere, there wasn't a lot of fear, people would be more comfortable. They'd get a better product. You know, people would be able to work and know when they get hurt, they won't be put back on the same job. You know, they'll know if they got a temp worker, they'll know after a year or 6 months or whatever, they'll be back, you know, with Nissan. You know, that's all we want. You know, we don't want a workforce of temporary workers to pay half pay, half benefit, work somewhere 10, 20 years, and have nothing to show for it.
Yeah.
You know, that doesn't make any sense. That's never happened in an industry, an automobile industry, the way I can remember. You know, it never happened like that.
Let me ask you a last line of questioning I've got for you, Ramil. You know, it sounds like you're extremely passionate about this. Do you have any background in union organizing? Do you have any background in unions in Mississippi personally?
I only really had 2 jobs my whole life. I'm 40 years old, you know, and I believe in working. My last job, I worked at 10 years, and I worked at Nissan for 10 years. But right in between that gap, I worked at a place, Brian Foods. You know, it was a place that was unionized. And, you know, I learned a lot from that little 6 months or so I was there at that place, and I realized that unions are the basis of that corporation to where people have a voice. And ever since then, I've been real passionate about unions. You know, it never started with Nissan. Before Nissan, I was interested in unions. I've always been. I knew it was something that Right to Work State didn't like, but that doesn't mean that Right to Work State do not have that right to organize. That's what people don't understand. They feel like it's Right to Work, you can't have unions. You know, that's the misconception. You're in the South, they don't believe in unions, come to the South, you ain't got to worry about unions. No. You still, by law, able to form unions. And that's what people don't understand in the South. You know, we have policemen, firefighters, teachers that are part of, you know, the teachers' union. Our tax dollar pays their pensions and their health care and things like that, but we allow companies to come in and get millions of dollars in incentives and won't give up the same opportunity to make sure these companies are treating us fairly. But it's hard to do that when a lot of people are afraid and intimidated.
Well, Ramil, I wish you guys nothing but the best. You've got a friend here at the program. Anything that you need from us that we can help with, please let us know. As this moves down the road, we want to know what's going on. I wish you nothing but the best. Keep up the fight and one day longer, brother.
Yes, sir. I appreciate everything. Thank you. Thank you for having me on the show. And if we need anything, like I said, we'll definitely get in touch with you because we need all the help we can get.
Thanks so much, Ramil. Ramil Nash, Nissan worker from Canton, Mississippi. The website, dobetternissan.org, if you want to find out more information about what's going on down there. Quick break, right back with your thoughts. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
We got to get older, right? We got to do it today. No more mystery.
to The Rick Smith Show. The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
Tales of American Political History with Clinton Porter Hackney.
We've been covering military photographer Bill Jones and his mission to record damage at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The 20-year-old Jones was not in tune with the historical significance of what he had been ordered to do. But he figured out from his senior officers that it was a big enough deal that he should develop his own personal set of photographs, though he knew they were to receive a secret classification. Jones was concerned about getting his set of photos home without them being confiscated by someone. He solved that by wrapping his 8x10s covered with paper around the barrels of two souvenir Japanese rifles that were nailed shut in wooden boxes. He then put 4x5 photos in the bottom of an ammunition box and stuffed his girlfriend's letters on top of the photos and wired the box shut. So join us again next time to see what happens stateside. This is Clinton Porter Hackney at cphackney.com.
Years ago, the delightfully naughty movie star Mae West said, "I used to be Snow White, but I drifted." Less delightful are some of the purity claims of such food manufacturers as PepsiCo, which has long marketed a line of its Frito-Lay snack foods as simply natural. Natural? Anyone who's even looked at one of the company's strangely puffed, caterpillar-esque, cheese-powdered Cheetos would have a hard time believing nature had anything to do with the concoctions. Sure enough, PepsiCo has quite a little natural claim from its snack packages, rebranding them with just the word Simply. The multi-billion dollar food maker says the shift is merely a routine adjustment of its marketing scheme. But it comes only after consumer groups have taken Pepsi, Campbell's Soup, and other manufacturers to court in the past couple of years, successfully challenging their use of the natural phrase as deceptive hype. PepsiCo settled one of its cases last year by paying out $9 million to the challengers and agreeing to stop labeling its Naked Juice brand as all natural. A marketing pitch for these drinks had bragged that they were, quote, the freshest, purest stuff in the world. The naked truth, however, was that they were not only juiced up with artificial vitamins and synthetic fibers, but also included an additive made from formaldehyde, a cancer-causing compound. This is Jim Hightower saying, the conglomerates say that advertising terms like natural are widely misunderstood by us stupid consumers. Well, there they go again, drifting from the truth and perverting plain English. Natural simply means what it says. Natural. As in, go squeeze an orange and don't dose it with formaldehyde and lies. To keep up with the industry's drift from purity, link up with Organic Consumers Association. They're at www.organicconsumers.org. Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, hightowerlowdown.org.
The man who sends the investor class diving for attack shelters. Rick Smith.
At every trough you stop to feed. With your arrogance, your ignorance and greed. Now here come the cuts and redundancy. Through the absolute indifference, the avarice, incompetence, your arrogance, your ignorance, your greed.
1-888-520 Rick, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website, The Rick Smith Show. .com. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I do answer all emails personally. You know, as I was talking to Ramil there, it took me back to our labor history tour. And when we were in Kansas City, one of the guys who gave us the tour of the area took us over to the old Ford building where he said, you know, you see this beautiful park with swing sets and with basketball hoops and monkey bars and all this just beautiful park. Where you go, you know, nothing bad could happen here. And he said, you know, back during the Depression, when this plant was pumping out, vehicle after vehicle, this whole field here, packed with men looking for work. And the management used to tell the guys, look out there, we can do whatever we want to you, because any one of those people will come in and take your job in a heartbeat. And this is what happens when you give so much control to one side of the equation. When you give too much power to corporations, or it doesn't matter, when you give too much power to anyone. Because what's the old saying? Absolute power corrupts? Absolutely. Well, what we're seeing is an absolute corruption of power. And I go back to the National Labor Relations Act, which originally gave no rights to employers whatsoever. Nothing. Not one right was given to employers because of that act. Because they understood that the employer has all the rights. They have all the power. And this was simply saying, you know what? We're going to give those workers a shot. Just a shot to sit down and to organize and to collectively bargain and to have that voice. And it's always been mind-blowing to me that you would have people who say, well, I don't want that. I don't want to have a voice where I don't want to know nothing. Don't leave me. Don't tell me nothing. Without knowing the history. I mean, you go back and you look at these situations. And it's not just the Ford plant back during the Depression. It was all of the companies at the time. When you had high unemployment, like we've had the last couple of years, you get these employers who figure, hey, now's a shot. Now's the time to go and take those wages. Now's a shot to get those benefits. And now's a shot to get us that temporary workforce. And we've seen we've talked about these stories across the country for years now. We've seen it time and time again where an employer says, well, you know what? I don't need a workforce. Let's bring in a third-party logistics company so that anytime I want, I can just cleanse myself of those people and bring in all new people. And yet the workforce is supposed to be loyal and dedicated to that, really? And what gets me, you know, you look at the Nissan situation, much like the Volkswagen situation, $1.3 billion in subsidies and tax handouts went to this company. And as I've read the reports, and we've had Greg LeRoy from Good Jobs Firster on the program a number of times, when they did their report on this, they showed that the $1.3 billion that was given out probably wasn't a great deal, because the jobs that they were promised didn't come to fruition, and the subsidiary jobs, the ancillary jobs that were supposed to come, didn't as well. There's no clawback, so there's no way of getting any of that back. So what you've got now is you've got a situation where the jobs that were promised are now going to become temp jobs at some point, if this organizing doesn't happen. And then you'll see profits continue to skyrocket. And I saw this report today. I don't know if you paid attention, but corporate profits, another record year. Yay! Get the screamers, get the poppers. Another record year for corporate America last year. Profits after tax, this is the money that the corporations put into their pocket, about $1.7 trillion with a T, $1.7 trillion. Now remember, we were told if we give them huge tax breaks, they're going to use that money to create jobs. That's in addition to the $2 trillion they're sitting on offshore. Stop and think about it for a bit. All of this money we're giving to these big corporations, why? I'm not seeing the job creation. Sorry. It's not happening. What's interesting is when you look at this graph from this Quartz group, who mocked up the numbers, the total corporate profits, $1.7 trillion. Domestic profits here in the U.S., $1.3 trillion. And around the world, about $400 billion. And you go, wait a second. World profits, very small. Domestic profits, huge. Why? Wages are plummeting. Wages are being stolen away at every opportunity. And, you know, for me, I shouldn't say wages are plummeting. The CEO class, fat and happy. Record high in 2012. Record high. Congratulations, CEOs. Bang. Almost $10 million apiece for the top 50 CEOs of publicly traded companies. And good on you, man. And I'm sure that came from the workforce. Now, wages for you and me and working people, slowest growth since the 60s. barely, and I would argue not keeping up with inflation, just at inflation. And in fact, if you looked at the numbers, wages have declined since 2007. What we're seeing right now is a lost decade. And I remember when the Bush collapse happened, they were going, oh, hopefully we won't have a lost decade. Here we are. 2000 to 2012, wages have flatlined and actually declined, while productivity has jumped 25%. Now, remember, the people would say, meritocracy, the more work you do, the more money you make, right? Wrong. Wages flatlined. Productivity went up 25%. Who pocketed the productivity gains? Who put that money in their pocket? Oh, $1.7 trillion. Gee, if we had a mechanism, if we just had something where workers could go, you know what, I created all this profit, I should share in it. Oh, yeah, like a collective bargaining agreement? Oh, yeah, which is why the Republicans are working diligently to make that illegal. Since 2008, corporate profits have grown 20 times faster than that of workers' incomes. And you wonder why there's all of this money in our political system to push business friendly. Folks, we've been business friendly long enough. Let's take a quick break. Right back. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425.
Listening to the Rick Smith Show.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by Ask Me Council 13.
This is the Media Matters Minute. I'm John Kerr. On Fox News' The O'Reilly Factor, host Bill O'Reilly brought on House Budget Chairman Paul Ryan to absolve him of remarks he made criticizing the work ethic of inner-city men that many felt had racial undertones, including Representative Barbara Lee. However, O'Reilly only made the situation worse.
They don't want to solve the problem. These race hustlers make a big living, and they get voted into office by portraying their constituents as victims. And it's all your fault, and it's my fault. It's the rich people's fault. It's the Republicans' fault. It's everybody's fault except what's going on. And what's going on, as you know, is a dissolution of the family, and you don't have proper supervision of children, and they grow up with no skills, and they can't read and speak, and they have tattoos on their neck, and they can't compete in a marketplace. And that's what's going on.
Congresswoman Lee gave a rebuttal on MSNBC's All In.
Race hustler, welfare queen, food stamp president, these code words are to be expected from the right wing. However, they should not be accepted.
For more on this and other stories, please visit MediaMatters.org.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
You know, one of the things that catches my attention, again, I go back to that $1.3 billion that the state of Mississippi gave to... Now, understand, this is $1.3 million that could have come from education, infrastructural improvements, from other things that could have been invested in the state. This was a conscious decision to take tax dollars and to put it into building, handing over to this company to build a plant that chances are they were going to build there anyway. And this is what gets me. What we've done in this country is we've given these big corporations this bargaining chip. By telling them, well, you go wherever you want, and there's going to be a bidding war, so have at it. And then we pit states against one another to see who's going to give the sweethearted of the sweethearted deal. And what's been interesting to me is, you know, you look at the plant in Tennessee and the plant in Mississippi and the one in Alabama where they've given a lot of money to, and you ask the question, you know, what if we would have done that to the American automakers at the time, which we didn't. They didn't have that advantage. And what I find really very disturbing is a lot of the southern states, politically the ones who tell us that, well, we were anti-government, we don't want government in our lives, and government's bad, and we want lower taxes, and we want all of these things. Turns out that the southern states, they are the ones that seem to be the big welfare queens. And I'm not just saying this because it's the truth. I'm saying it because, well, Wallet Hub, this financial social network group, they have come out with the best and worst states for taxpayers report. And oddly enough, how they came up with this is they looked at all the states and they compared them on three primary metrics. They looked at the return on taxes paid to the federal government. So for every dollar, like South Carolina is the perfect example of a welfare queen, for every dollar they send to Washington, they get, and I hope you're sitting for this, they get $7.87 back in federal monies. So, you know, you got to go. If you're the senators or the representatives in South Carolina, good for you guys, because you've been able to con people into believing that you want smaller government, less taxes, and all of that stuff, while bringing home huge, massive, enormous amounts of pork at the expense of, well, the Northeast. And I just, especially like states like Delaware, who for every dollar that they send to Washington, they get something like 50 cents back. And you can go down to the list and look at some of these numbers, which is it's just staggering when you look at how much like Massachusetts, for instance, for every dollar they send to Washington, they only get 94 cents back. But you go to Illinois or Minnesota or New Jersey, where you're talking 50 cents, 60 cents. California only gets 94 cents back. Kansas, and I mean, if I'm Kansas, I got to be screaming. You're only getting 71 cents back. And you go to the bottom of the bottom of the barrel, where you've got the Mississippi, you've got the Florida, $4.57. You've got the West Virginia, $2.22. You've got the Louisiana, $3.35. The Alabama, $3.28. The New Mexico, $2.87. The Mississippi, $3.07. Then you go, for every dollar they spend, they're getting almost triple the money back. And South Carolina, almost eight times the money back. And you go, you know, what are they using it for? You want to talk about redistribution of wealth, folks? This is a massive, massive, massive redistribution of wealth. Not just in the northern states, but in the southern states as well. Because that money could be used for education. That money could be used for so many other things than going, here, here's a handout. Here's your corporate welfare. But, you know, we don't hear many people talking about that. Because, well, I guess if you did, you wouldn't get any advertising dollars in the media. But the states who are the ones who are getting screwed are like Delaware and Illinois. And then you've got the southern states, the Tennessees, the Louisianas, the Alabamas, the Mississippis, you know, who are just raking it in. And you go, what happened to fair competition? What happened to my Tea Party friends who keep talking about redistribution of wealth? And this is what we're seeing. And look, I'm not making this up. So when you hear these, and the same thing with the healthcare laws, the same thing with the social safety net. When we took our tour, we went to some really dirt poor places that no one, absolutely no one of rational thought, no one of common decency would say, I'm going to deny resources to those areas. And I watched a video on Mississippi where they put this plant, and we're talking dirt roads, and we're talking abject American style abject poverty. And look, I'm not against investing heavily in those areas to make sure that everyone has a minimum standard of living in this country, to where nobody in our country lives in abject poverty. But what's frustrating and angering to me is what we have done is we have taken that goodwill money where we're going to build those communities up. And we've given it to these corporations because they've told us, we're the job creators. We create the jobs. And then you find out that, yeah, they've created jobs, but they're not what they sold us. And time again, this plays out. We give boatloads of cash. They fall short of expectation. It ends up costing more. And then we end up having to either pay more or we end up subsidizing their workforce with Medicaid or with food stamps or with other things. And I keep asking the question, is it worth it? And, you know, poll after poll shows that people are in favor of giving money to corporations to create jobs, which I just think is dumb. I think what we should be doing is we should be creating demand. And you go, but Rick, how do we do that? I go, NASA, you know, the space project, huge, enormous driver of the private sector. You know, there are so many opportunities of ways that we should be spending our tax dollars that don't include, here's a big cardboard check, that don't include a campaign rhetoric of, oh, we brought this plant across the road like they do here in Pennsylvania. They brought, literally, they brought a factory, a research facility and its production line from Phillipsburg, New Jersey, across the river and across the toll booth into Easton, Pennsylvania. And it was like a 5 mile, 5-6 mile difference. But with it came a huge amount of money. Here's some cash. Lots of it. Here are our low interest loan guarantees. Here are land grants. Here are subsidies for power and all the other stuff that we give out. And you go, how's it benefiting us? What we should be doing is we should be investing in things that we need and saying private sector, supply it. See, to me, that seems rational. These handouts, not so much so. And this idea that and I love it because all of the crazy Republicans seem to come from southern states, the ones that are high on this wallet hub list of welfare kings and queens. They're the ones telling us we don't need it. They're the ones telling us we don't need no stinking government. Yet we'll take your cash. And we'll take large amounts of it. That's what's frustrating. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, therickSmithShow.com. That's where you go to get the podcast, Stitcher on your smartphone. We've got all the little widgets and whatnots there at the website. You can click on, you can watch the video of me flailing my arms around here on our YouTube channel. Lots of ways to interact with the program. I'll also take your thoughts, your questions, your comments, whatever's on your mind, Rick at therickSmithShow.com. Quick break, right back with hour two. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. I'm the talk.
Yes, it is all about the children, even after they're born. Rick Smith. It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
Newark airport workers are sick and tired of poverty wages as airlines there ignore the New York, New Jersey Port Authority's directive to raise wages by $1 an hour on the way to a minimum of $10.10 an hour. Kevin Brown is a vice president with SEIU 32BJ.
Anybody know who Jeff Smizek is? He's the president and CEO of United Airlines. He earns more in 1 hour than the workers who clean his airports in airplanes in 3 months. Shame on you. Shame on you. Shame on you.
Audio in this story courtesy of New York City's Labor Press. The United Steelworkers are applauding a World Trade Organization decision calling on China to end tight controls on exports of rare earth minerals. The United Steelworkers say that China's manipulation of the supplies of these critical manufacturing materials has cost the U.S. many good jobs and is hurting the U.S. alternative and renewable energy sectors as well. Action on this stemmed from a complaint filed by the USW under Section 301 of U.S. trade law. The union filed the complaint against what it says is a broad range of Chinese predatory and protectionist policies that are harming U.S. workers and the American economy. Rap music business mogul Sean Diddy Combs has some encouraging words for Nissan workers in Mississippi struggling to form a union and get a voice on the job. The workers are allied with the civil rights movement to overcome anti-union actions by Nissan. In a video addressed to Nissan workers who are having an event in Mississippi, Combs said standing up for workers' rights is important, especially in Mississippi.
Workers' rights are civil rights, particularly in the U.S. and the South, particularly where Mississippi has a history of the rights of people being disregarded. And history teaches us that the only way to achieve justice is to stand up for our rights. I'm proud to stand with Nissan's workers who have the right to not be intimidated or threatened.
Two unions representing federal workers, AFGE and NTEU, say that a House bill to give federal workers a 3.3% raise is a welcome and needed step to get federal pay back on track. The Fair Compensation Act is sponsored by Democrat Virginia U.S. Representatives Gerald Connolly and James Moran and Democratic Representative Elijah Cummings of Maryland. The unions say federal worker pay didn't cause the budget deficit and federal workers have already sacrificed enough with multi-year pay freezes while the cost of living keeps rising. The freezes amounted to $138 billion in lost wages, which means $138 billion less in money being spent in the general economy. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
There are many employers that say, you know, we're looking for people, but we can't find anybody that has passed the drug test, a lot of them. And that's a concern for me because we're having a serious problem with that.
Go, go, I messed up my entire life because I got high. Go, I lost my kids and wife because I got high.
Say what?
Now I'm sleeping on the sidewalk and I know why.
Why, man?
Yeah, because I got high. Because I got high. Because I got high.
I got to tell you, I love the Corbett quote. And again, you know, first it was, if you remember when he was campaign Corbett, it was because people were lazy. There are jobs out there. It's just they're too lazy. Those people, too lazy to go get them. And then it was, well, they can't pass drug tests. All drug addicts. Which again, ludicrous. Completely, totally ludicrous. But you know, a good thing just happened the other day. State Senator Mike Stack proposed two pieces of legislation, Senate Bill 1307 and 1308. The one that says, you know, if you get caught, you get into trouble, this one little thing, one little drug conviction, of this very small amount of marijuana, of which I have a couple of friends who that happened to back in college, not going to ruin your life, not going to follow you to the day you die, which I think it's about time. Right? It's about time we grow up as a society on this issue. But here to talk about his legislation, I've asked Senator Mike Stack to come talk with us. Mike, thanks for taking time for me.
Rick, thanks for having me. Great to be with you again.
You know, so I look at the legislation you put forth, and first I got to ask the question, why now? While you're running for lieutenant governor, isn't this something that could be quite divisive?
Listen, everywhere I go, people talk about the waste of our greatest resource, which is young people and their futures. And I have run into so many young people and people who aren't as young, who made a mistake years ago, that say that they've got a black mark on their record forever for something stupid like a little bit of marijuana use or a small amount of possession years ago. It ruins their life forever. And then there's also people who have this kind of thing on their record who have been incarcerated. This is used in combination with other things to give them relatively long prison sentences. They come out, they don't have an opportunity to realize any kind of potential because of this arbitrary black mark on their entire future. And so in all walks of life, Rick, I've had conversations with people about this, and I think decriminalizing marijuana in small amounts of possession or in usage, it just makes common sense. And let's not ruin people's lives. Let's give them a chance to have a great and productive life. And guess what, Rick? These people are people who can occupy jobs that won't need, government benefits because this will be good for the economy and you know, so if people are really concerned about harnessing our greatest resource and stopping the waste of government money on prisons or on charging people in the criminal courts, and really want to spend money wisely, we could save a lot of money if we do that.
No, and it's just common sense. I mean, to me, at a certain point, you've got to be an adult about this. I remember I had a couple of friends back when I was in college. They got caught with just a personal use amount. And, you know, they're in their 40s now going, it's still there.
Man, it just makes no sense. And, I run into employers all the time and say, we meet really great people. But under our own regulations and law, somehow, you know, sometimes you have jobs that are, I guess, quasi-security related, or people will deal with money or other things like that. So they'll be unable to hire the best applicants because of the stupid black mark on something that happened a long time ago, and it was not a big crime when it happened, but. God forbid it's on the record, and it sure appears that way. So, yeah, let's move into let's get people caught up with the times of reality and stop punishing people forever for stupid little things like this.
No, I'm right there with you. But you know, as someone who drove a truck for years as part of my living, you were almost done. You get a drug conviction like that. Stick a fork in yourself because you're probably not getting a job doing that even. And to me, at some point, it's just ludicrous. You did say something that caught my attention. You used the word decriminalize. We're not talking about legalizing then, right?
No. You know, that's an issue we could talk about later, but really, you know, Pennsylvania is an incremental type state. We rarely do anything sort of dramatically all at once, but the first step in decriminalizing, you know, it's this idea that, you know, if somebody's being prosecuted for a criminal conviction, they have to go through that whole criminal justice process for the most part. They have to be treated just like other hardened criminals in that process, where I don't think that's where they belong. But if we decriminalize, it means that, you know, for one or two time offenses of recreational use or harmless amounts or personal use, that you could do it through paperwork as a summary offense. And the amounts of money that would save, well, a lot of, there was one study from Harvard that says we spend $1 billion a year in Pennsylvania just prosecuting folks for marijuana.
Wow.
And just think about all the other things about, which we just talked about, the fact that they can't get jobs, then you got other folks that are going to be involved with recidivism, and then the other costs that we have to spend in other government programs. All this we can save and use, let's say, on public education. How's that? And higher education. I think we could use the money in those areas much in a much more positive way.
That's immediately right where my mind went. $1 billion. We could put back all of that money that Corbett took out of education and give my kids and my kids' classmates a real shot. And I bring this up every time I talk to someone. My sixth grader sits in a class called LGI, and I want every politician to know what LGI stands for. Large group instruction. My sixth grader is sitting in a class with 100 of her peers in large group instruction, and I'm going in sixth grade. I had university courses that were not that large.
You know, I mean, how can anybody really learn anything productive in that kind of setting? And, you know, and you think when kids are young, too, particularly like sixth grade, there's a lot of other distractions that go on. And 100 kids, I mean, grown-up people in graduate school, like you said, You're not going to be able to. It's going to be tough enough to learn in that environment, but a young person, prepubescent, or about to go into adolescence and all that stuff, it's impossible to learn. So, what a betrayal of our young people to put them in that kind of environment. And yes, of course, dress it up. LGI, did you say?
Yeah.
Which is another way of saying we're failing our kids by overcrowding them into just unacceptably large classes.
But you'll be happy to know that they had enough money for the standardized tests, which I opted my daughter out of. You listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're here with Pennsylvania State Senator Mike Stack. He's also running for Lieutenant Governor, stackforpa.com, the website. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Senator Stack's name. Take you right there. Let's talk about that. How are things going on the trail?
Rick, it's really exciting. I'm getting a chance to visit all over Pennsylvania and talk about our progressive ideas. And you know what? Pennsylvania doesn't have the reputation of being a progressive state, but it is, because people are fed up with the state being turned over wholesale, the big business, the super wealthy, and the super greedy. And they want America back, and they want Pennsylvania back. And so people, they want justice, they want equality, they want economic opportunity, they want the minimum wage increase, they want the little guy looked out for a little bit more, a lot more. And so we're really excited. We've gotten a very positive response everywhere. And, you know, Rick, I'm from Philadelphia. And sometimes people think you're from Philadelphia, that may not resonate necessarily across the state, but we have found a lot of connections where people who are struggling and going through many of the challenges that are going on in Pennsylvania, most Pennsylvanians, it's the same thing wherever you are in Pennsylvania. So our message is really resonating. I think we can get Pennsylvania moving in a positive direction and being a leader. And where we've been, you know, under the Corbyn administration is in the bottom in pretty much everything. And James Carville said that we were in Pennsylvania. It was Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, and Alabama in between. Well, guess what? We're really just all Alabama these days.
And that's a scary thing, because for me, this election cycle is about stopping the insanity. You know, 3 years ago, we were in Wisconsin, fighting against Scott Walker's push to destroy public sector workforce and really fundamentally change the state into a corporatocracy. And I see the same thing happening right now in our General Assembly, in the House, and now in the Senate with this anti-stalking bill that they're actually considering passing through. To me, stop the insanity and get back to what we really need to be talking about, are jobs.
Listen, and it's one a game of let's hide the ball from the people after another. This supposed stalking piece of legislation is nothing but anti-union, anti-collective bargaining, anti-fairness, justice, and equality in the workplace. And it's the state has been turned over steadily to the interest of big business, and we can't do it anymore. And I think the difference between what's going on in other states and in Pennsylvania is we're running into more and more folks that realize the imminent danger and know that we've got to stand up now. And people have to do it not just in a broad sense by speaking out, but have to pay attention to who's getting elected to the state house, to the state senate. These folks are getting elected saying one thing. They get in there and they have sold their votes and their souls sometimes to big business. So folks have to pay attention to what's going on and realize that we can give no more quarter to big business if there's going to be economic justice in Pennsylvania and there's going to be job opportunities. And we've got enough of the potential in our state with our education system as far as higher education. We've got businesses that want to come here, but we have to set reasonable standards and first and foremost, you got to take care of your workers.
Let me ask you last line of questioning I've got for you. You look at last night we were talking with Barry Kaufman from Common Cause about, some of the lobbying gifts and some of the things, the sweetheart deals that industries have gotten. And, I can look at no better sweetheart deal than what the drilling industry has gotten here in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. A couple $1 million they spread around to the governor and others has reaped them hundreds of millions of dollars in tax savings for them and tax costs to us. How do you go back and you fix what this administration has done over the last 3.5 years?
Well, I think you got to get a new administration, and you definitely have to have an extraction tax. And they've had an extraction tax in every other state other than Pennsylvania. Other states use their extraction tax revenue for roads, for public education, and for us not to be doing that in Pennsylvania is obscene. It's unjust. And yes, the only way we can right the ship is to put an extraction tax in place. And if we have to get rid of Tom Corbett, which I think we do, to do that, we should. And the other thing is, you know, what about Pennsylvania workers? I mean, can we look out for Pennsylvania workers for once? You see all those license plates from Oklahoma, Texas, New Mexico. Plenty of people are coming from out of state to reap the benefits of the wide open drilling, and we're doing nothing legislatively to protect Pennsylvanians, which we should do. We should, first of all, we should try to find a way to say, look, you have to give first priority to Pennsylvania workers or you're not going to drill. And then we need to make them accountable to do that. And listen, we need to make them pay their fair share. And we need them to guarantee, that what they do is safe. And, all these things can be done and have been done in other states, but Tom Corbett, just wants to give away the state's resources without making them accountable or responsible to the people of Pennsylvania.
Well, it comes down to the campaign cash. At least that's my view on it. So let me ask you then, when you look at Rob McCord's plan of a 10% drilling tax, is that on line with your thinking? Is that too high? Where are you at?
No, I think 10% is a good number. Because it is not that far off of what other states have set. And also we haven't had one in place. So, it's a reasonable number to make up some of the revenue that we've absolutely lost. And what I would do is I would use the 10% number that Rob McCord has put up there, and I would take at least 5% of that, to help fund higher education. And I have a plan, called the Mike's Pack Promise for Pennsylvania, in which I talked about this at the Progressive Summit, in which I think that any Pennsylvanian and all Pennsylvanians should be able to go to college for free. And we can find a way to do it. And a 10% tax on the Marcellus Shale drillers is part of the way to get us there.
Yeah, if they're gonna take the resource out from under our feet, we should at least benefit from it, I think. And the fact that right now we're actually pulling West Virginia down just sends the wrong message.
Oh my gosh, yeah. We can do better. And, I think we're all aware we can do better. We deserve better in Pennsylvania. And, I don't like to just keep kicking Tom Corbett, but he's had a lot of opportunities, turn things around. And, I don't see how you can ever say we're going to cut education, we're going to cut the adult basic program, we're going to throw people off the insurance rolls, we're not going to expand Medicaid to make sure that everybody has a chance to have good health insurance. We're going to let people not just fall through the cracks, we're going to throw them over the cliffs wholesale. That's what's been going on with this administration. And people from Pennsylvania, all walks of life, whether Republican or Democrat, the bottom line is they deserve better, and we can do better. And I'm hearing that when we get out there all over the trail. And I know you hear that, Rick, and I appreciate you carrying the banner to the fact that we need to do better.
And we will, hopefully, this November. The primary's in May, May 20th, correct?
Yes, sir.
And we hope folks will get out and vote. I hope a much better turnout than we saw in the 28th senatorial district, but that's another story for another day. The website, stackforpa.com. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Mike, it's great having you on the program. Come back again soon.
Thanks, Rick. Great being with you.
Thanks so much. Again, stackforpa.com. Quick break. Back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. For working people from the top.
I got a picture in my pocket of the lucky one. I'll announce the winner on the radio. With my microphone, I do a super show. I wear a cowboy hat. You did my business hat. I'm on till 1 a.m. I must tell you that I'm a man with a mission.
The Rick Smith Show. Teaching America for the better.
This is the Media Matters Minute. I'm John Kerr. On Fox News' The O'Reilly Factor, host Bill O'Reilly brought on House Budget Chairman Paul Ryan to absolve him of remarks he made criticizing the work ethic of inner-city men that many felt had racial undertones, including Representative Barbara Lee. However, O'Reilly only made the situation worse.
They don't want to solve the problem. These race hustlers make a big living, and they get voted into office by portraying their constituents as victims. And it's all your fault, and it's my fault, it's the rich people's fault, it's the Republicans' fault. It's everybody's fault except what's going on. And what's going on, as you know, is a dissolution of the family, and you don't have proper supervision of children, and they grow up with no skills, and they can't read and speak, and they have tattoos on their neck, and they can't compete in a marketplace. And that's what's going on.
Congresswoman Lee gave a rebuttal on MSNBC's All In.
Race hustler, welfare queen, food stamp president, these code words are to be expected from the right wing. However, they should not be accepted.
For more on this and other stories, please visit MediaMatters.org.
Years ago, the delightfully naughty movie star Mae West said, "I used to be Snow White, but I drifted." Less delightful are some of the purity claims of such food manufacturing giants as PepsiCo, which has long marketed a line of its Frito-Lay snack foods as simply natural. Natural? Anyone who's even looked at one of the company's strangely puffed, caterpillar-esque, cheese-powdered Cheetos would have a hard time believing nature had anything to do with the concoctions. Sure enough, PepsiCo has quietly dropped the volatile natural claim from its snack packages, rebranding them with just the word Simply. The multi-billion dollar food maker says the shift is merely a routine adjustment of its marketing scheme. But it comes only after consumer groups have taken Pepsi, Campbell's Soup, and other manufacturers to court in the past couple of years, successfully challenging their use of the natural phrase as deceptive hype. PepsiCo settled one of its cases last year by paying out $9 million to the challengers and agreeing to stop labeling its Naked Juice brand as all-natural. A marketing pitch for these drinks had bragged that they were, quote, the freshest, purest stuff in the world. The naked truth, however, was that they were not only juiced up with artificial vitamins and synthetic fibers, but also included an additive made from formaldehyde, a cancer-causing compound. This is Jim Hightower saying, the conglomerates say that advertising terms like natural are widely misunderstood by us stupid consumers. Well, there they go again, drifting from the truth and perverting plain English. Natural simply means what it says. Natural, as in, go squeeze an orange and don't dose it with formaldehyde and lies. To keep up with the industry's drift from purity, link up with Organic Consumers Association. They're at www.organicconsumers.org. Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
Time for change. It's time to rearrange. Time for change. Time for change.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
You can't tell me we're gonna make it somehow. I heard a wise man say revolution starts now. I think it's time for change.
Yeah, time for change. And that's why November, I think, is coming just... not quick enough in my view, but November's coming, and that's when we exercise our rights to term limits. One of my favorite term limits, the right to vote. You know, think about the power that you have as a voter to throw the bums out. And you look at the last 3.5 years in Harrisburg, a lot of bums. A lot of bums to be thrown out. The hope is that we actually do it. Honestly, truthfully, I mean, it's one of those things that makes me go, now would be a good time. Now's a good time to get the bums out. And just on the drilling issue, this is what just stops me in my tracks. Look, I'm not in favor of drilling. The reality is it's going to happen. It's going to happen. And I know there are some people who go, "Well, Rick, you're wrong. We can stop it." Look, the train has left the station. The ship has sailed. What we need to be focusing on is regulating it. Heavily regulating it, making sure that if they're going to do it, that they pay for all of the externalities, that they pay for the destruction, they pay for what has to be remediated and cleaned up. And we don't allow them to shove that stuff off on us, the taxpayer. At this point, that's the reality in my view. We're not doing that. This, whatever you want to call fee, that they're nowhere near enough. And what, this is one of those things that makes me go, we just don't seem to understand. You're selling this stuff throughout the country, and eventually they're going to sell it globally. It's going to happen. The wheels are working toward that. And thanks to what's going on in the Ukraine, it's going at hyper speed. Eventually we're going to be selling the gas everywhere. So if that's going to happen, and you know it's going to happen, you know that's where it's going to go, the big money wants it, the political class wants it, all of those folks, they want it, it's going to happen. So why not put in the idea of having other people pay our tax around the globe? I mean, that's the thing that grabs me. Have as high as taxes you want, because you and I aren't going to be the ones paying it. The consumers of the gas are going to pay it. And oh, by the way, did I mention that it's already built in to their business model? When the drillers made their choice to come to Pennsylvania and stick the needle in the ground, they already knew what the tax rate that they were willing to pay was going to be. They put it into their costs. They're already paying it. The only difference is they're paying it to themselves. They're not paying it to us. And they're leaving behind all of these external costs that we're going to bear. Maybe that's just too pragmatic. Maybe that's just too realistic. Look, I would love to be one of those people to stop it, and I'm going to chain myself to the oil derrick, and not going to do any good. The moneyed interests in this state have steamrolled us in that way. And look, you know, when you're given these false choices, and you go into those areas where there are jobs being created, there are people who are making a living at this, there are companies that are flourishing, there is some activity. What you're saying is, again, we're giving them false choices. This is all we've got. And I think back to going through West Virginia where the woman said, this is it. This is all we've got. You want to take all we have away. And I'm going, man, the ultimate false choice. Right there. That's what we're talking about. And, you know, for me, a 10% tax, that should be it. That should have been done already. But no, the drillers, they bought and they paid for their politicians. And we went along. We bought into the nonsense. Oh, well, they won't come. Yeah, like they're going to develop technology to get the gas that's under the ground here in Pennsylvania from China. Yeah, good luck on that. Let me know how it works out. But hey, don't give them any ideas. They may try. It's just one of those things that makes you go, folks, we need to have a little common sense. It's a little thought process. Just go right there. Anyway, let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. One of these days we're gonna wake up.
Changing America for the better.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
The steel strike of 1919 was called the Hunky Strike because most of the workers were either first or second generation immigrants from Eastern and Central Europe. Up until the end of World War I, workers had benefited from shorter hours, better pay, and the promise of union recognition. Once the war came to an end, the mill owners pursued anti-union open shop policies and other cost-cutting measures. During the strike, there was near total suppression of all civil liberties. Major work issues included the 12-hour day, the 7-day work week, scores of workers being injured and maimed, union recognition, and poverty wages. Mary Harris, better known as Mother Jones, fought tirelessly throughout her life for social justice and human rights as a labor leader and a worker advocate. On August 20th, while visiting striking miners in Homestead, Pennsylvania, home of U.S. Steel's famous Homestead Steelworks, she defied injunctions against public gatherings and addressed 5,000 striking workers and their families. This speech led to her being arrested and jailed for giving an unauthorized speech. When brought before the judge, she was asked who had signed her permit to speak at a public gathering. She answered, Patrick Henry, Thomas Jefferson, and John Adams. As the strike went on, Mother Jones, the grandmother of all agitators, gave many speeches to rally the workers. One speech in Chicago was described by a spy for the U.S. War Department's Military Intelligence Division as the foulest and most profane that can be imagined, teeming with ultra-radical suggestions. Welcoming the spies, she would invite them to the front of the crowd so they could report her words accurately. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
Yes, bound to lose. And all it really takes is you and me and our neighbors and our friends and our family, all of us standing together, shoulder to shoulder, saying, you know what, united we will be victorious. We cannot be divided. And I look at what's going on in Memphis, Tennessee right now. Right away I called them scab flakes. When Kellogg's locked their workers out back in, I believe it was back in, October, November, where they said, look, you know, we're kicking these people to the curb because we can. I said, you know what? Scab flakes, that's what this is. In fact, it was October 22nd when Corn Flakes kicked their long-time dedicated workforce to the curb. Why? Because they could. Because that's what hugely profitable corporations are doing right now. They're taking advantage of the conditions so they can slash wages, they can hollow benefits, and they can gut workforces by saying, hey, at least you got a job. So I look at what's going on in Memphis, Tennessee, which tomorrow is the day Dr. Martin Luther King marched with the sanitation workers there in Memphis back in 1968. We are reliving a lot of the same history, which is why we've got to stand together, and which is why I've asked Ron Baker. He is the campaign strategy guy over at the bakery and confectionery workers, the people who represent the Kellogg workers out there in Memphis, Tennessee, to come talk to us. Ron, thanks for taking time for us.
Hi, Rick. How you doing tonight?
I am good, and I understand some really good news on your end.
Yeah, we took another very positive step today in addressing what we have been saying since October the 22nd, that the Kellogg's had illegally addressed certain items at the bargaining table, which were master contract items, and then illegally locked folks out for insisting that they accept those illegal terms. And today, the National Labor Relations Board came down with a ruling that actually affirmed every charge that was placed against the Kellogg Company in October of last year.
That is fantastic news. And what does that mean for your workers then?
Well, I mean, actually, I mean, there's a process here, but I mean, what we're maintaining, and we sent a press release out about 5 minutes actually before I got on the show here, we're maintaining that they should abide by the general counsel of the NLRB, his decision, that it is clear cut. I mean, he's actually not only addressed the fact that they threatened to lock up persons, locked out bargaining unit people, and did so over illegal terms, non-permissive subjects of bargaining. So we're maintaining that, look, you should, look at the facts. You should agree with the decision. You should mitigate the damage that you have done. And you should, put the people back to work. And let's try to, recreate some semblance of order and
get the right people in the right places. Kellogg can do their business, and our people will do the business they do, which is producing cereal better than anybody in the world.
And then I can start buying Kellogg products again.
Yes, yes, but, you know, I mean, they have time to, you know, as the board process goes, they can look at this, and they have to submit by April the 10th whether they'll appeal or not, and if they do appeal, there's a May 5th hearing or whatever. I mean, quite frankly, the pressure for Kellogg's is that we have been saying this all along. They are saying that we were wrong all along. And we continued to maintain and had clear-cut evidence that that they violated and wanted to pick off one unit at a time to break the master agreement, and the board affirmed it today.
And, you know, the only thing that I can see that they would want to continue this is to just try and starve the workers out and punish them a little bit longer. That's all I can come up with.
Yeah, well, one thing about it, too, with a finding like this, and it's certainly not at this stage yet, but, you know, if the board, I'm sure, will consider that if the issues were illegal that they pressed the membership on, and they locked out that membership because it wouldn't accept those illegal provisions, therefore the lockout's illegal, therefore there's probably back wages, back health insurance, any amounts that been incurred by the workers as far as damages that this company could owe. And every day that goes by, I mean, is continuing a more and more of a liability for them.
And in my view, it should go to that, because at some point there's got to be a message sent to these big companies. When you break the law, when you force these things to happen, there should be consequences.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, I mean, you know, in every other area of life, I mean, there's consequences for violations, and today they got slammed with a pretty heavy decision. I mean, we've maintained the new corporate leadership in the last 3 years somehow feels that they don't have to follow any rational path of cooperation with the union like we have for in the case of Memphis, for over five decades, and that they can muscle their way through and do as they please because they're not the number one producer in the world. But today this decision basically says, you know, you have violated the law, and it doesn't pay any deference to whether they have a $14.2 billion sales every year.
You know what's interesting to me, Ron Baker, is I look at earlier in the program we talked to a worker from the Nissan plant in Canton, Mississippi. And one of their big complaints, one of the reasons that they're organizing and trying to form a union is the company is using all of these temporary employees that are disposable. And, you know, I look at the situation that you guys are in. That's the way Kellogg wanted to go. They want to bring in all temporary people, as I understand it. Correct me if I'm wrong. But they wanted to get rid of their seniority people and just bring in disposable workers.
Yeah, they maintained, well, what they were trying to do, Rick, I mean, yeah, in essence, I mean, they wanted to, they tried to play a word game here and say, well, you know, we want to bring casuals in, but they're going to be full time people and they're going to make less money and they're going to be not covered by benefits. And you know, the bottom line to it is it gets back to what you have said repeatedly on this show, and you've been a champion of doing. It's like, every way, whether they're profitable, extremely profitable, or grossly profitable, they continue to want to squeeze every penny out of the people that actually put them in a position to be one of the best companies in the world.
I mean, I've often said, you know, that you get these corporate CEOs, they'll squeeze a quarter to where the eagle screams unless it's going into their pocket. And you look at the reports that have just come out, corporate profits last year have never been higher. $1.7 trillion in after-tax profits, according to the last number that I saw of the big 50 companies. You're talking $1.7 trillion, and you look domestically, it was $1.3 trillion of that came right from here, from the U.S., and you go, it's because we've been squeezing workers. It's because wages have flatlined and declined. It's because of all of the assaults on your members, on the workers in Tennessee and in Mississippi and here in Pennsylvania, that these obscene, massive profits are there. And I say what this is, you know, I'm going to steal the Tea Party's line. This is a massive redistribution of wealth from people who create the wealth and work for it to the people who sit in boardrooms and shuffle money from one pocket to the other.
Absolutely. And it's assault on, you know, the Memphis situation is indicative, and you said it time and time again when you draw analogies with other places. I mean, these fights are over middle class jobs. And quite frankly, if middle class jobs in this country go, if people can't afford to buy what they bought in the past, I mean, it's almost like the last man standing club when it comes to corporations. Like, how much money can I suck out of middle class people or people that are actually buying the products or whatever before the whole thing caves in? Because, I mean, quite frankly, you can't impoverish people or put people in a place where they're working for dirt poor wages to expect them, the economy to, like, flourish, because those millionaires that are in the 1% and billionaires that are in the 1% don't buy all the automobiles that these companies produce, don't buy all the washers and the dryers and the refrigerators and everything else. It takes people that have disposable income in their pocket to do it, and you can't do it on dirt poor wages.
And you certainly can't do it on company script either, which is basically what we've recreated through the credit card system.
Yes.
So in the coming days, what should we be looking out for? Because the reason I think it's so important that we talk to folks like you there in Memphis and people in Mississippi and in Tennessee, because I think workers, we're all connected. What happens to you, what happens to people in Mississippi or China or elsewhere happens to us. We're all interconnected. And I firmly believe in the old Knights of Labor, an injury to one is an injury to all. What should we be looking out for?
Well, we should be looking out for exactly the company's response to this. I mean, you know, if you know, the natural thing that they should do is to abide by the decision, try to patch up what they can patch up, get folks back to work, and understand that their plan and path, you know, was horribly conceived and miserably executed, and quite frankly, it wasn't the right thing to do. I will tell you, I'm with those folks down there in Memphis. I mean, they're a brave bunch of people, but you know, the hardest thing, Rick, for them to understand is how they can get 20, 30, a couple people, 54 years of service, and have a relationship where the union and management work through problems repeatedly. And one day, over an issue that they want, they inflict the power of the corporation to kick them to the curb and act like they don't even know them. That is the most debilitating thing when it comes to this relationship, in addition to the wages and the health care that they've lost. But what we can look for in the future, we still got to maintain and got to still continue to move forward for this to come out the way it should. So, I mean, people need to continue to support this effort. And, you know, we got the Kellogg Green website up. I don't know whether you've seen that or not, but it's there's four testimonials on there, and it's done in video. And if we can get that around and shopped around, believe me, they don't like the bad PR, and actually we think that's had an impact too.
Which is why we've got a link to the RickSmithShow.com. Just click on Ron Baker's name. It'll take you right to the Kellogg Greed website. Also, we've tweeted it out. We want to make sure everyone takes a look at it. You know, because here's the thing, and this is the last point I want to make on this. Just the other day, a friend of mine said, you know, he one of his neighbors worked for a company 38 years, gave her entire life right out of high school to this company, worked every job, knew everything without any notice whatsoever. They walked in and her and a bunch of other coworkers, they just walked out the door, wouldn't even let her take her coat. They pushed her right out the door. And you know, this is the kind of respect, this is the kind of treatment workers in this country unfortunately have become used to, I think. And it's only because your members were members of your organization that's not maybe not going to happen to them, which is why I keep saying Every CEO in this country has a contract. Therefore, oh, yeah. I believe every worker should have a contract.
Yes, John Brown's got a pretty lucrative contract. As a matter of fact, you know, when you mentioned, Rick, about, you know, the stock market going up and wealthy individuals making more money or whatever, here's a guy that heads a company whose mission in Memphis is to squeeze every nickel out they can, even if it is under an illegal plan. But here's a guy that went from $6.6 million a year to $8 million in one jump in 12 months. Now, you talk about a redistribution of wealth. I mean, on one hand, you're saying the cereal, you know, you're not making money off of cereal, but you pocket $1.4 million plus, you know, it's beyond belief.
Well, what it is, it's the money he expected to take from your members and the workers exactly. who are members of your group, your organization. It just is what it is.
Yep.
Ron,
exactly.
I wish you guys nothing but the best. Congratulations on the good news. As this continues, I'd love to have you come back and talk to us again. And when the victory is at hand, we most certainly want you back.
Thanks, Rick, and thanks for everything you do, buddy. Take care.
Appreciate it. Ron Baker, Strategic Campaign Coordinator with the Baker Confectionery Tobacco Workers and Grain Millers International Union, BCTGM. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Time to talk.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
It's Thursday, March 27, 2014.
This will have to be reckoned with as a failure of policy, given the repeated warning over and over and over again, over a period of generations in clarion terms, warning that this was going to happen.
More disturbing details on the deadly Washington landslide. Rooftop solar will endanger the electric grid?
That's another bullshit argument,
says the former energy secretary. Plus,
there's a huge procrastination penalty when it comes to emitting carbon into the atmosphere.
Irreversible climate change could arrive as early as 2036.
All of those irreversible penalties and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comments.
Solar energy has always sounded way too gay for rednecks. Instead, say, invade the sun and take its oil.
There you go. Now we're talking. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, earlier this week I spoke about the repeated warning from scientists, geomorphologists up in Washington State, warning against catastrophic failure that has in fact happened up there in this landslide, deadly, horrible landslide. You've got more information on that today.
Yes. Right now, as we go to air, 25 dead and 90 still missing. And while near-record rainfall was the direct cause of the landslide, the Seattle Times reports that excessive logging may have contributed, with aerial photos indicating a clear-cut logging operation went outside the safe boundary approved by regulators in the area and stripped trees from the mountaintop directly above where the landslide occurred.
And you can see this clear-cutting in these photographs from the U.S. Geological Survey. The cutting comes down just to where the entire side of that mountain just gave away.
Yeah, and anti-logging activists say state regulators really aren't doing enough to rein in logging companies.
Color me shocked.
The oil industry is celebrating the 25th anniversary of the Exxon Valdez oil spill with a spate of new oil spills. As we reported earlier this week, first there was the significant crude oil spill into Galveston Bay. Now, a BP refinery in Michigan that was just upgraded has spilled 21,000 gallons of crude oil into Chicago's water supply, Lake Michigan. Way to go, BP.
Way to go, oil industry. Unbelievable.
Climate change is going to affect nearly every aspect of human life and will cost trillions of dollars in lost economic output. That's the cheerful consensus from a leaked draft of the next UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report. It focuses on the impacts of climate change and is due out next week. Now, the window to act on climate change by cutting emissions is closing, according to Michael Mann of the famous hockey stick temperature graph. In a new paper, the climate scientist calculates that at our current rate of carbon dioxide emissions, we will hit 450 parts per million CO2 in the atmosphere as early as 2036, and that has consequences, as he explains to Tom Hartman.
If you do the math, we hit that 450 parts per million number in a matter of a couple decades, and we probably lock in at least 2 degrees Celsius and some very dangerous and potentially irreversible impacts on the planet.
Got that? In just 22 years, we commit to global temperatures rising at least 2 degrees Celsius. And it won't stop there.
The CO2 we are putting into the atmosphere right now is going to add to warming for decades into the future. It will cause sea level to rise for centuries into the future. So there's a huge procrastination penalty when it comes to emitting carbon into the atmosphere.
And I suspect we are not going to be ready to pay that penalty.
Not at our current rate, but there is some good news. Renewable energy technologies are scaling up faster than predicted, booming around the world. Wind and solar made up nearly 90% of all new electricity generation installed in the U.S. just last year.
And when you say booming, unlike with the oil and natural gas, you don't mean exploding. You mean it's actually increasing in sales around the country.
Indeed.
Thank you.
Speaking of the boom in renewable energy, former Energy Secretary Stephen Chu has a blunt message for utilities trying to preserve their monopoly over electricity by trying to kill off rooftop solar. He says it's, quote, bull. He says utilities should instead embrace the rooftop solar revolution and adapt their business model.
As solar and batteries especially get cheaper and cheaper, the utility company partnership with a private company owns the modules. They own the battery. They use your roof. They sell you electricity for cheaper.
Yeah, you know, like it or not, we live in a capitalist society. There are all kinds of ways for people to make money off of renewable energy. The problem is there are ways that will cut into the profits of the fossil fuel industry, oil, coal, natural gas. That is the only reason for this ongoing war on science, this ongoing war on reason. For much more on those stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Please consider a donation to help us stay on your public airwaves. And don't forget, you can download us anytime via iTunes, Stitcher, or TuneIn, where we hope you will leave us a good review so more people will hear the Green News Report. Find us and follow us on the Facebook and on the Twitters at Green News Report. From bradblog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
I sold 3,008, you sold 2,000 and late. I got that boom, 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 that future boom, boom, boom. Let me get in that.
Boom, 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 gotta get that. Boom, 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 gotta get that. Boom, 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 gotta get that. Boom, 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 gotta get that. Boom, 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 that.
Standing up to conservatives and corporatists every weeknight, The Rick Smith Show.
So now you see the light, hey, stand up for your rights. Come on,
get up, stand up, stand up for your rights. Get up, stand up, don't give up the fight.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therixsmithshow.com. So it was 110 years ago on this very day, Mother Jones was in Colorado stirring up the coal miners, saying, hey, you know, the company script that you're getting, the price of everything that you pay doubled, tripled, the fact that you're generationally in debt, the fact that when you're injured, they throw you to the curb, the fact that when someone dies on the job, your family is kicked to the street, or your wife is going to have to curry favor with the mine boss. That's our history, folks. And, you know, you go back and you look at that history, you look at how we got where we are, and it all came about because one worker looked at their coworker and said, enough already. We are going to change things. We are going to make things better for not only ourselves, but for our children and our grandchildren. And you look around, and, you know, I talk to people every day who they don't know. Most of them don't know what I do. And, you know, I give them a chance. I give them the chance to lay it out. I'm like their free therapist. Say, go on, you know, tell me everything that's wrong with what you do for a living. every pet peeve, every complaint, every tell me about how horrible the boss is. And people just let go. And you go, can you change that? And they feel helpless. They feel helpless. And I'm telling you, there's an alternative. There's an option. You don't have to. I mean, everybody deserves dignity and respect. Everybody. It is that simple. And I look at this campaign that's going on right now to raise the minimum wage. And to me, a minimum wage should be a living wage. We should be setting that floor to where you go, you know what? You can afford an apartment. You can afford to put food on the table. You can afford to take care of yourself without going, oh, can I please? Can I have health care, please? Can I have food stamps, please? Can I get heating assistance, please? Connecticut yesterday, the General Assembly there, they voted to raise the minimum wage to $10.10 an hour. The first state to pass legislation pushing President Obama's goal of $10.10 an hour. Now, if you remember, Obama's original thought was $9. You know who changed this? You did. Working people changed that. All of those fast food workers across this country who said, we're going to fight for 15. Every one of them, they were the ones who, they made it possible. And that's what pressure does. That's what saying, you know what, we're going to stand together. We're going to fight for something that is going to make our lives better. And to me, that's where we go. And that's where we need to really be focusing on, you know, how do we make tomorrow a better place? How do we make it better for our children? You know, I had a nice little quick conversation the other night with a guy who works at Walmart who says he listens and he's in favor of increasing the minimum wage. And I guess you could make a couple of arguments. One, it's going to help him. But more importantly than him, it's going to help all of those people below him as well. It's going to help society because we understand. And this is where I think we need to have a little bit of thought. You put more money into people's pockets, they've got more money to spend. This is common sense. More money that goes into your local economy. You got to think about it in small little bubbles. The more money that's banging around in the bubble, the more access there is to generating more income and the more opportunities to start small businesses and have those businesses grow. The more opportunity there is for workers to strike out on their own, which is why I'm absolutely in favor of the health care law, giving people the chance to go, you know what? I'm going to throw out my own shingle. I'm going to give it a shot. You know, that's why you have strong social safety nets. That's why you have strong bankruptcy laws so that people try. They strike out onto their own, and if they strike out, they don't strike out. They don't die. They don't hit the bottom. They don't end up in poverty because we want to encourage people. We want to encourage them to try. Problem is you've got the Mitt Romneys of the world who have abused our bankruptcy laws throughout the years. But for me, it comes down to very simply, very, very simply, we need to stand together, which is why I'm so happy to see in Mississippi and in Tennessee and in southern states, you've got workers who are saying, you know what, we're going to stand together. Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith. It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
Yeah.
Newark airport workers are sick and tired of poverty wages as airlines there ignore the New York, New Jersey Port Authority's directive to raise wages by $1 an hour on the way to a minimum of $10.10 an hour. Kevin Brown is a vice president with SEIU 32BJ.
Anybody know who Jeff Smizek is? He's the president and CEO of United Airlines.
John Akison.
He earns more than the workers who clean his airport, his airplanes, in 3 months. Shame on you.
Does it ever get to be
shame
on you.
Audio in this story, courtesy of New York City's Labor Press. The United Steelworkers are applauding a World Trade Organization decision calling on China to end tight controls on exports of rare earth minerals. The United Steelworkers say that China's manipulation of the supplies of these critical manufacturing materials has cost the U.S. many good jobs and is hurting the U.S. alternative and renewable energy sectors as well. Action on this stemmed from a complaint filed by the USW under Section 301 of U.S. trade law. The union filed the complaint against what it says is a broad range of Chinese predatory and protectionist policies that are harming U.S. workers and the American economy. Rap music business mogul Sean Diddy Combs has some encouraging words for Nissan workers in Mississippi struggling to form a union and get a voice on the job. The workers are allied with the civil rights movement to overcome anti-union actions by Nissan. In a video addressed to Nissan workers who were having an event in Mississippi, Combs said standing up for workers' rights is important, especially in Mississippi.
Workers' rights are civil rights, particularly in the U.S. and South, particularly when Mississippi has a history of the rights of people being disregarded. History teaches us that the only way to achieve justice is to stand up for our rights. I'm proud to stand with Nissan's workers who have the right to not be intimidated or threatened.
Two unions representing federal workers, AFGE and NTEU, say that a House bill to give federal workers a 3.3% raise is a welcome and needed step to get federal pay back on track. The Fair Compensation Act is sponsored by Democrat Virginia U.S. Representatives Gerald Connolly and James Moran and Democratic Representative Elijah Cummings of Maryland. The unions say federal worker pay didn't cause the budget deficit and federal workers have already sacrificed enough with multi-year pay freezes while the cost of living keeps rising. The freezes amounted to $138 billion in lost wages, which means $138 billion less in money being spent in the general economy. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Proudly blue in an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
Now we all ought to feel just a little bit guilty when we look into the eyes of our kids. Cause brothers, it's facts. If we take and don't put back, they'll have to pay for all we did. So let's leave some blue up above us. Let's leave some green on the ground. It's only as we follow, let's save some for tomorrow. Leave it and pass it on down.
Wouldn't that be a nice idea? Make sure that the planet is livable for my kids and my grandchildren, who I hope to at some point meet, and maybe their children and so on down the line. Maybe leave a little bit something, just a thought. I know we've been told that, hooray for me, carpe diem, live for today, hooray for me, screw everybody else. But it would be nice to, think down the line. And I see this story that points out that carbon dioxide levels at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Hawaii laboratory and analyzed in Boulder have reached a disturbing benchmark. They keep saying, I remember, there are groups like 350.org, that if we hit 350, that's like the tipping point. It's the end of everything. Evidently, we've blown right on by 350, according to their readings, and all the way up to 400 during this one reading period, which is why we've asked John Atkinson. He is Energy Policy Director at the Nebraska Wildlife Federation to come talk to us. John, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
So explain this 350 parts per million of carbon dioxide. I was under the impression, and look, I'm not the I'm not the green guy here, just a concerned parent who's thinking about what am I going to leave to my kids. I thought 350 was like the point of no return, and now I see we're 400.
Well, 350 is an important benchmark, but we sort of got stuck on it because there's this wonderfully effective organization, 350.org, that took it as its name. what the numbers really are is the parts per million of CO2 in the atmosphere. I mean, we're talking per million. It's tiny. And I remember when I first started learning about this stuff, I'm thinking, parts per million? Are you serious? You're telling me all this is going to happen from something that's a small part of the atmosphere. You're measuring it in parts per million. Plus, it's less than 1% of the atmosphere. And, you know, I read my first book on it, and I decided, you know, I'm going to debunk this sucker because he's really pissing me off with this. Except that it turns out that with carbon dioxide and the other greenhouse gases, that's just enough to keep the planet more or less in temperature equilibrium, energy in, energy out. Sun comes in, we radiate heat out into outer space when the sun's not heating us up. And, you know, that really is the way it works. Before the Industrial Revolution, when we really started jacking up the amount of CO2 we put in the air, it was more like 280-ish parts per million.
And how do we know that?
Interesting ways. Well, that is interesting ways we do know that. One thing is that there's people who actually had jars, and they put the lids on, and they put them on the back shelf, and they sat there. And maybe, like, somebody gave them to the Smithsonian Institution that was in the back of the storeroom in the bottom basement in the far corner. Well, that's air from then, and you can actually take that and analyze it. Likewise, you can drill down these big core drills that take these cylinders of ice way down in the glaciers in Greenland and Antarctica, and there's bubbles in there. And you can actually take that air and get the parts per million of this, that, and the other thing, examine what kind of isotope of oxygen atom it is. Richard Paley, who I think is not far from you over there at Penn State, actually wrote a book called The 2 Mile Time Machine. 2 mile long iceberg goes back hundreds of thousands of years, and they have ancient air that they actually take and analyze. So we figured 250, 280 parts per million in the atmosphere before the Industrial Revolution. And then we start cranking it up, and we blew through 350 not that long ago, as you know, and we're just now entering the era of 400. Now, there's a cool thing here, and what that is this laboratory on the top of Mauna Loa in Hawaii has reported an amazing thing. And, of course, they put the lab, the atmospheric lab, out there because it's on the top of a volcano. There's relatively few people. It's not by a big source of pollution or anything. By the time all the air circulates around and gets to the middle of the freaking ocean, it's pretty well mixed up, and it's going to be average air in that sense.
Right.
What they discovered, they started in the late 1950s, and they were measuring CO2. And it falls and rises every year. When life blooms in the northern hemisphere in the spring, it sucks up carbon dioxide, makes leaves out of it, makes flowers out of it, makes stems, makes trunks, and the plants are breathing in this CO2. And of course, luckily for us, what they breathe out is oxygen.
Right. I remember that, the whole plants. Photosynthesis from eighth grade biology.
There you go. And then plants change the atmosphere of the whole planet. Used to be mostly CO2, and now it's down to a very, very small part because of the plants. This planet has been terraformed to be terra by its own life. And later in the year, when the leaves fall and the deciduous plants in particular shed a lot of their matter, and they go dormant more or less for the winter, well, they're releasing CO2 instead of sucking it up. And so the graph that they get on Mauna Loa and the analysts in Colorado, when they graph this stuff, you see it going up and down and up and down, and we are literally seeing the breath of Gaia. This is not some woo-woo New Age stuff. This is hardcore. We're watching it. And it's really a great way of planetary self-regulation. But it's also pretty darn awe-inspiring in my book. So they've been watching this since the late 50s. And why did they start watching it? Because since the beginning of chemistry, in the middle of the 1800s, they had figured out, hey, there's oxygen, there's some CO2. Well, what do we know about that? I mean, it's hard to remember. But this people had to figure this out from scratch. And they figured out things that seem important now, like you fill up a flask with carbon dioxide, and not as much infrared light goes through, not as much heat shines through that as it does with other gases. So already they know that CO2 absorbs some of the heat. And they started speculating, especially later in the 19th century, early 20th century, you know, we're burning a lot of coal. We know that produces a lot of CO2. I wonder what would happen if we doubled the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere from what it used to be. And it sounds crazy, you know, in the age of supercomputers and climate modeling, but they took out their little quill pens and their paper, and they did the math by hand, and they came up, you know, with some answers and some formulas, and they said, yeah, that's about right, and they put it away. And for the simple effect just of the CO2, they were pretty spot on. It's fairly simple, sort of high school level chemistry and physics.
But what do you say? Well, let me ask you this. What do you say to the person who, you've got a representative from Minnesota, Michelle Bachmann, who said that, you know, basically all this carbon dioxide talk is just voodoo, it's nonsense, it's hokum, it's a hoax, CO2 is a harmless gas. You know, it's harmless.
Well, you know, in the right quantities, it's harmless in almost every situation. In the right quantities, oxygen will kill you, and in the right quantities, water will kill you. It is called drowning, and that's something we have to have. But sure, people can say whatever they want to say. You know, you can make stuff up, and if you have the right connections, you can get it on TV and print it in the newspaper. It does not make it fact. And the important thing about science is that a scientist works on something, they publish their findings, and immediately the next thing has happened is everybody says, I don't know about this. Let me see if I can duplicate this. And after a while, if it works out the same way every time and you refine techniques and you figure out what's really going on, then people accept it and you go on about your business. And that is what has happened with all the science around global warming and climate change over the last 100 years or so or more, because bit by bit, they went from seeing that CO2 absorbed some of the heat, figuring out that you add CO2 to the atmosphere, it's going to cause the whole place to warm up a little bit. And now at least 97% of publishing scientists in the relevant field are, I think this is old, boring, and yeah, it's happening, what's all the excitement about? Now they're about refining it and seeing what the feedback loops are, like melting ice and so forth, that make the whole thing go faster and get rougher. So Bachmann and some of my own representatives here in Nebraska say, oh, it's a big hoax. Well, you know, if you want to just go by whatever you want to make up, that's fine. But I got over that in grade school, didn't you?
Absolutely. And, you know, I look at this as very serious when 97% of the science community is telling me that there's there. I'm not the expert. They are. When 97% of a field tells me there's there, I believe there's there.
It's like if we were sick, we would not go to the body shop and ask for a prescription and what was wrong with us. And if we went to the doctor, like we ought to, and the doc says, you got cancer, it's bad, well, we'd for sure get a second opinion. But would you keep shopping around until you found somebody who said, oh, just take this and you'll be okay?
No, get me to the snake oil salesman. Quack.
Exactly. And, you know, there's, unfortunately, the folks in the media feel compelled to have this drama. You know, oh, it's a hoax. It's the largest hoax ever perpetrated. And they all make it up and blah, blah, blah. And leave out the part that there's such a thing as fact. Global warming, theory of how that works and has worked out for us to be causing climate changes by putting too many greenhouse gases up. That's a theory, just like there's a theory of gravity. and it's just about as controversial.
Yeah, I'm allergic to I'm allergic to gravity, to be honest with you. I don't bounce well.
I could do a little anti-gravity belt. Wasn't there suggestions? I could go for that, man.
But here's the thing. I mean, so I'm with you. There's a serious problem. This 400 number got me really concerned. But, you know, looking at what you said, you know, when things are growing and the leaves are growing, is there a way that we can change what's going on? Are we completely screwed? What's the future look like?
Well, as best we can tell, and you know, we've gotten pretty good at marking out some of the things. But remember when I was telling you the breathing in and the breathing out of the CO2? That's every year. But over the years, that jiggy-jaggy line keeps going up and up and up. And, you know, even that line itself, with all its annual bumps, that waves a little bit because stuff changes. It's not a smooth curve like we plotted it in high school algebra. This is nature. It's just a little messier than that. And so when we get to touch 400 for the first time last year, it got everybody's attention. But 400 isn't any more special than 399, except it started ringing some good alarm bells. And we'll go below 400 again later this year, and we'll come back to it again next year. And after a while, that will be the number. We will settle all year on 400. But the thing to remember is that we caused it, and we can stop it. What's the old saying? What's the first rule of holes? If you're in one, stop digging.
Right.
So the main thing that the problem in the United States of America is generating electricity. Because we burn coal, we burn natural gas, and that life cycle process of using those fuels puts a lot of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. So switch from the dirty stuff to the clean stuff. That's number one. The second biggest contributor of greenhouse gases in the United States is the transportation sector. So one of the things you do right away, since we know pretty easily how to do that, is make the transport sector electric. Now, there's a lot of electric trains, a lot of electric subways, and so forth. So we're partway there. We're beginning to electrify cars. We're beginning to have some street cars again that are electric. Right now, if you run an electric car, you're already doing a little bit better than your inefficient internal combustion engine, your gasoline engine, because it's just so much more efficient to make the electricity in a big plant, even if it's burning coal. So let's go ahead and electrify the cars. When we get our electricity supply off of coal and gas, the dirty fossil fuels, then we'll have a hell of a twofer. You know, we've got the transport sector, we've got the power sector, and we're not putting so much greenhouse gases into the air. That could happen pretty quickly. Over the course of 10 or 15 years.
If we wanted
exactly.
to.
Yep, it's the political will.
Yeah.
But
I think you gave them a bailout there a second ago because you said, you know, the first theory of holes is when you're digging, stop. Like you think that we can just, at a certain point down the road, much further down the road, we'll do it later. Because, you know, we can turn it around down the road because that's what I took. Cause, well, you know, it's bad now, but yeah. Won't get much worse down the road. We can always turn it around later. Is there a point of no return where, because I was under the impression 350 was it. You hit 350. There's no going back. Is there going back?
Yeah, but it's sort of like driving at high speed towards the cliff in the dark. You don't know exactly where the edge is. We're very confident that if we don't get much above 450 and then crank it back to about 405, we will probably have avoided the worst consequences of the climate changes and we'll still be on a planet we recognize. It'll be different. You know, it won't be like the one you and I grew up on, but it'll still be the Earth. If we get much beyond that, things get out of control and we're done. So there's a lot of question about exactly where that line falls and how do we take carbon dioxide back out of the atmosphere? But we do know that we're late in the game. Remember, there was concern in the 50s enough to put this monitoring station up. in the White House in the 50s, LBJ, their science advisors talked about it. In the 70s, the really hardcore science papers were starting to be written by scientists like James E. Hansen. And in 1988, Hansen sat before Congress and said, global warming is real. The preponderance of evidence is that it's already starting to kick in and the climate is changing and we need to do something about it. So nobody who pretends to political leadership after 1988 should get a free pass, because that was a clear warning. And at that point, shouldn't we have been doing the things that were no regrets, like reducing coal-fired power plants and burning coal to make steel and all those things that are extremely dirty and harmful in many other ways to human health?
Yeah, yeah,
so
I'm with you.
And then if the climate scientists turn out to be the bunch of kooks that the Tea Party says they are and the Republicans say they are, well, you know, we haven't really lost much. We've actually improved life. But no, they dug in their heels, and big business, oil and gas and coal in the very first place, said, no, this is baloney. We're not doing anything. Let's wait until the science is done. This is like with tobacco. The tobacco companies didn't have to sell it as a health food. They just had to plant the seeds of doubt that this was really causing cancer. And they killed millions of people just by the sowing of doubt. And the same people have been doing it for the fossil fuel companies and global warming.
Yeah, and I blame all that. I blame all of it on Ronald Reagan. Because if you go back to the 50s, Reagan was actually selling tobacco as cigarettes as a cure. If you remember, not a cough in a carton, wearing the doctor coat and the whole nine yards. And then if you remember when he became president, one of his first acts as president was to rip the solar panels that Carter had put on the White House off the White House and put them into storage.
The symbolism there was very powerful on both sides. And, you know, it symbolism is important, you know, and what people believe is important because it tracks, you know, what we're going to do. And it's just amazing. Luckily, things are beginning to move in the general population. When you get people, if you sit people down, have them take an opinion poll across the country, 60 to 90% of the population knows global warming is real and it's a problem. And they want the Environmental Protection Agency to protect the environment by capping greenhouse gases at the power plant and other industrial sources. But you'd never know that to watch the news on TV. It's just an amazing thing. You get a blip here and there. But for something that's in the process of profoundly changing the world, they really don't pay much attention to it. And to me, I think it's news.
Yeah, I think it's news as well. But for me, I'm not, like I said at the beginning, I'm not the expert here. But I am a guy who looks at it much as you said. Let's say it all is a big hoax. Putting solar panels on my house cut my electric bill by 40-50%. It helps keep the environment a little bit cleaner. And maybe moving to electric cars, going to get us off of foreign oil or all of that stuff, couldn't be bad. I don't know many people who want to suck the tailpipe emissions out and breathe that into their lungs. So it couldn't hurt. Even if all of it is a hoax and it's all made up, I still think it's a step in the right direction, although I do believe it is real.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny because somehow the way it's talked about in the media, where they give these people who deny reality such credibility, we talk in terms of belief. Do we talk about anybody believing or not in gravity, or believing or not in whether the sun's going to come up, or believing or not that the earth is round? You know, it's one of the few things that I really, really like that President Obama has said in the last year is in that June speech about climate, when he talked about, well, you know, we're not about having a meeting of the Flat Earth Society. And he nailed it.
Yeah.
Because this is not a matter of belief, you know, any more than gravity or the sun coming up.
So last question I've got for you then, you know, if this is, because everybody wants to know, when's it going to happen? Because maybe the change that we're seeing is so incremental that we don't see it in our lives. Will it be too late by the time we actually see the change?
Well, there is a lag. I mean, right now the changes we see are more like a change of context. We used to talk about, well, you can't tell, you know, you can't say this big storm was caused by global warming. And the thing about that is it's the wrong question. Every storm now operates. Every storm is created. Every storm has its global warming component, like Hurricane Katrina that destroyed New Orleans. It was made roughly 20% stronger by occurring in the global warming context. You take it back 20 years, you wouldn't have nearly such a strong storm, but it was that 20% that topped those levees
right.
and destroyed a major American city and kept it underwater for weeks. Superstorm Sandy, it wasn't even a hurricane when it hit ground. But these big storms that are jacked up by warmer than historical averages on sea surface temperature, I mean, that's where they get their power, is the warm water at the top of the ocean. They just suck it up. This is a peculiarity that we're going to have to learn to think about, because it wasn't a hurricane, but it flooded the subways of New York City. That was a milestone and a turning point. And I think, you know, that's the thing. It's the global warming, slow warping on huge scales is really starting to get people's attention, whether it's wildfires, drought, storms, just things being odd, the way the jet stream wiggles around, you know, it's got to have its global warming component, exactly what that is. We've never destroyed a planet this way before. We have to figure it out, and it's going to take a while. But we do know the big picture, and we do know we need to stop digging this hole, stop burning fossil fuels, and we may have to do something to stop the entire fossil fuel industry before they stop us.
That's an interesting way of putting it. We've never destroyed a planet like this before. That's
kind of weird.
It is kind of weird to say. I mean, wow. Or that we know of, anyway.
Well, you know, we've dug some pretty deep holes, and I think if this was a cyclical thing, we would have figured that out by now. But yeah, it's a pretty wacky situation. It just seems weird, and like I say, there's a lot of things when you first get into it that just seem so improbable. Like I remember thinking, now I always like to read popular science and stuff. I only have a high school education. Okay, I didn't take a lot of college. I've been going to school for 40 years. I'm just not done yet. But I like to read this stuff, and I knew that the glaciers, you know, we're somewhat cyclical, and it took processes of tens and hundreds of thousands of years, which really is related to the Earth's orbit around the sun, has a small but very powerful impact on the Earth's climate. And so I'm thinking, now, the climate scientists are telling me that the glaciers are melting, and it's going to happen in a matter of a few hundred years. And, you know, we're talking about something that, so far as I know, always take tens or hundreds of thousands of years. So you've got to be kidding me. Well, but you really have to think twice when you see the side-by-side pictures of the same glacier, and it sure as heck is retreating up that mountain. And
yeah.
You say, well, we better rethink this. So that, you know, I don't blame people who are skeptical, but people who are skeptical to the point of being pathological deniers of reality, not so much.
Yeah, I'm with you. I don't blame skeptical. I blame stupid. And it is that simple. John Atkinson, I appreciate you taking time for us. Thanks so much.
Hey, you bet. Good to talk with you.
Fascinating, fascinating discussion. Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Thought-provoking, opinionated. Rick Smith.
Tales of American Political History with Clinton Porter Hackney.
We've been covering military photographer Bill Jones and his mission to record damage at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The 20-year-old Jones was not in tune with the historical significance of what he had been ordered to do. But he figured out from his senior officers that it was a big enough deal that he should develop his own personal set of photographs, though he knew they were to receive a secret classification. Jones was concerned about getting his set of photos home without them being confiscated by someone. He solved that by wrapping his 8x10s covered with paper around the barrels of two souvenir Japanese rifles that were nailed shut in wooden boxes. He then put 4x5 photos in the bottom of an ammunition box and stuffed his girlfriend's letters on top of the photos and wired the box shut. So join us again next time to see what happens stateside. This is Clinton Porter Hackney at cphackney.com.
This is the Media Matters Minute. I'm John Kerr. On Fox News' The O'Reilly Factor, host Bill O'Reilly brought on House Budget Chairman Paul Ryan to absolve him of remarks he made criticizing the work ethic of inner-city men that many felt had racial undertones, including Representative Barbara Lee. However, O'Reilly only made the situation worse.
They don't want to solve the problem. These race hustlers make a big living, and they get voted into office by portraying their constituents as victims. And it's all your fault, and it's my fault. It's the rich people's fault. It's the Republicans' fault. It's everybody's fault except what's going on. And what's going on, as you know, is a dissolution of the family, and you don't have proper supervision of children, and they grow up with no skills, and they can't read and speak, and they have tattoos on their neck, and they can't compete in a marketplace. And that's what's going on.
Congresswoman Lee gave a rebuttal on MSNBC's All In.
Race hustler, welfare queen, food stamp president, these code words are to be expected from the right wing. However, they should not be accepted.
For more on this and other stories, please visit MediaMatters.org.
Years ago, the delightfully naughty movie star Mae West said, "I used to be Snow White, but I drifted." Less delightful are some of the purity claims of such food manufacturing giants as PepsiCo, which has long marketed a line of its Frito-Lay snack foods as simply natural. Natural? Anyone who's even looked at one of the company's strangely puffed, caterpillar-esque, cheese-powdered Cheetos would have a hard time believing nature had anything to do with the concoctions. Sure enough, PepsiCo has quietly dropped the volatile natural claim from its snack packages, rebranding them with just the word Simply. The multi-billion dollar food maker says the shift is merely a routine adjustment of its marketing scheme. But it comes only after consumer groups have taken Pepsi, Campbell Soup, and other manufacturers to court in the past couple of years, successfully challenging their use of the natural phrase as deceptive hype. PepsiCo settled one of its cases last year by paying out $9 million to the challengers and agreeing to stop labeling its Naked Juice brand as all natural. A marketing pitch for these drinks had bragged that they were, quote, the freshest, purest stuff in the world. The naked truth, however, was that they were not only juiced up with artificial vitamins and synthetic fibers, but also included an additive made from formaldehyde, a cancer-causing compound. This is Jim Hightower saying, the conglomerates say that advertising terms like natural are widely misunderstood by us stupid consumers. Well, there they go again, drifting from the truth and perverting plain English. Natural simply means what it says. Natural. As in, go squeeze an orange and don't dose it with formaldehyde and lies. To keep up with the industry's drift from purity, link up with Organic Consumers Association. They're at www.organicconsumers.org.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
It was an inside job. Found a well connected. Your middle protest. No merely rejected. It was an inside job. Like it always is. Chocolate. To business as usual.
Yes, business as usual, yes. You kind of wonder if that's what's going to get us into all of the trouble that we're in. Business as usual. You know, it's just how we've always done it, right? Oh, it's just how we've always done it. We've always had the big gas guzzlers. We've always done these things. And I got to be honest with you, I think John, hit it on the head. What harm is it? What harm is it to do the right thing? And I know we're inundated with these false choices, like the Keystone XL pipeline. I mean, to me, that's one of those false choices that they keep throwing at us. Well, we need the jobs. You're right. We need the jobs. Absolutely. You absolutely need the jobs. But those aren't the only jobs that are possible. So I'm just, you know, it's one of those things that leaves you, you know, scratching your head going, you know, exactly what are you talking about? So, you know, as we move along and as this continues, we're going to continue to talk about it because I think it's important that we do. And I think it's important that that we focus on some of these issues because, look, the whole corporate-controlled mainstream media, man, it's like they're bought and paid for on this. There's no rational. And maybe, you know, look, maybe I'm wrong, and I'm okay with that. If you tell me I'm wrong, and, you know, we can talk about that. But at the end of it, like you said, we may end up having to look our kids in the eyes and answer that question, you know, what did you do and why didn't you do anything about it? Anyway, quick break, right back. Stick around.
Spare a moment for the homeless, for the poor. Who cares about the deficit? We want a glorious war. Or was it a shell game?
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no. They're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by Ask Me Council 13. Would you die 14?
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Of it, news all over the place. In fact, this story from Arkansas really caught my attention. A breastfeeding mother, stay-at-home mother of three, was at a restaurant having a couple of cocktails with a friend. In fact, she claims she had two beers in about an hour and a half period of time last November. The waitress saw it, didn't like it, not happy. Says breastfeeding mothers should not be drinking alcohol. Call the police. Police came, said, find someone to take your six-month-old. You're, my dear, going to jail. Over two beers, over an hour and a half period of time. Now, the woman claims she's generally very cautious while breastfeeding because, you know, doing the whole cover-up thing, all that stuff. Now, you know, as someone who, you know, my wife breastfed for years, she doesn't drink, but I often wondered, you know, what are the experts saying? Like many things, experts split right down the middle. Half say, don't do it. Half say, oh, in moderation, what the heck? What's the difference? Some say, you know, a glass of beer or wine every once in a while, not bad. According to the American Academy of Pediatrics, occasional alcoholic beverage, acceptable. They recommend that women wait about 2 hours before breastfeeding. But, hey, that's okay, too. And when I was a kid, and I go back to, I mean, we've gotten really, really crazy in this country. When I was a kid, they were just giving me little bottles of alcohol just to shut up and go to sleep. Nobody was arresting them back then, were there? And nobody was arresting those damn nuns who used to beat me constantly. Anyway, let's find out what's going on around the world in Washington, D.C. I've got Justin Duckham, Talk Radio News Service. Justin, what do you think? Arrest her, throw her in jail, lock her up.
Great to be here, Rick. And, you know, I'm not going to touch that with a 10-foot pole, and I apologize. That's far beyond any realm of anything I have to deal with. I have never breastfed who I plan to, so I will not touch that.
All right, well, let's talk about the rest of the boobs, those in Washington. I understand the Senate and the House advanced a bill on Ukraine. What's that about?
Well, the House ended up today passing by a voice vote, a measure to ensure that there are additional sanctions placed against the Russians and Russian officials. Meanwhile, in the Senate, we saw an agreement to move forward with a plan that would allow $1 billion in aid for the Ukraine as well as sanctions as well. And now we are waiting for the House to take on the Senate version of the bill. This, of course, includes stripped-down IMF language that the administration was initially requesting that would have provided a number of reforms that the White House was certainly pushing until Reid backed down on that. So that is expected to take place tomorrow before it arrives on the president's desk for his signature.
Am I missing something here? But doesn't this seem kind of well after the fact?
You know, it certainly does, but, you know, there has been a number of delays. There were quite a few disagreements in the initial, you know, version of the legislation pushed by both houses. Initially, the House wanted to include language that would prevent the IRS from investigating certain groups for political moves, whereas the, you know, Senate, of course, is trying to include the IMF provisions requested by the White House. Neither of those look like they're going to be part of the final bill. And as a result, we're going to be getting, although, you know, much later, a version of this $1 billion aid package.
I just find it interesting that, you know, they've always got to throw other stuff in. Why can't you just do what you're supposed to do on this issue? Why can't it just be this and you go, okay, this is really important. We should get this done soon so that to the rest of the world, we look like we got our stuff together.
You know, that is, of course, a very good point. It doesn't look like we've necessarily had that happen for quite some time. And as Mr. Connell pointed out, once this aid package did move forward, there was a need to require additional amendments just because it had been so long since it was initially agreed to, and now we can no longer rely on the language as it once was.
So now that each of them have passed, they will come together, they'll figure it out. Is this going to go further? Will we see signature at some point?
You know, this is expected, of course, to be signed by the president, although a little bit later than anybody in the administration would have liked. But it looks like there is going to be additional sanctions coming through, you know, either executive means or from the international community. So this may be an issue that Congress comes back to revisit in a, you know, fair amount of time.
Alrighty, good. The other thing popped up, the Senate advanced the unemployment insurance compensation bill. Didn't they already do this once?
They did move forward with an advancement, and then that ended up failing to receive the number of votes needed. Now it looks like they got the bare minimum to move forward through, you know, Republican hurdles, but it doesn't look like it's going to move much beyond that. It's likely, of course, going to pass through the upper chamber, but once it goes down to the House, it's likely going to flop after we've seen Republican leaders, including House Speaker John Boehner, pointing to a signed letter from a number of state insurance officials saying that these are not realistic measures put forward by Senate Democrats and that this would cost states a good chunk of cash as well as, you know, take a great deal longer than anybody would really want to implement it. And there's also, you know, other cost issues being raised for how it's being paid for, of course. That's been going on for quite some time. Initially under the, you know, Reid-Heller version of this, this was going to be paid for via pension smoothing. And it looks like there could still be some more pay for it demanded at the end before any of this moves forward.
So here we are. I mean, it's the end of March already. They left out of town there in D.C. like Scrooge prior to Christmas. They left, I guess it was December 28th, the end of the federal extension. So here we are 3 whole months later and still nothing.
Exactly, and that's something that has been frustrating for quite a few unemployed Americans, as I can imagine. This language would also include retroactive payments for those who have had to go without unemployment insurance for a good, you know, two or three months or so. And again, that's something else that has, you know, raised some eyebrows since that would come with a pretty hefty price tag that not many members of the House would be willing to agree to.
Yeah, so as Boehner was running around touting that it was going to cost a little bit of money to the states, have they looked at how much it's costing the states in other programs that the states are now having to administer? Because, you know, as I've talked to a number of state legislators, they're like, you know, when the federal money comes in for these extensions, it actually helps the state economy. It's actually good for our state's economy not to lose thousands of jobs and to have money circulating through the local economy, especially special federal dollars.
No, exactly. Once you, you know, lose your money, you become less of a consumer. And that, of course, as we all know, has far-reaching implications. And, you know, of course, for Republicans who have believed in trickle-down economics for so long, based on the idea that once you have more money, you end up helping your community and it spreads around, it's a little surprising that we're not seeing that logic being applied to this one.
Well, it's not a big enough trickle.
There we go.
This would just actually, like, be a little trickle. They like fire hose. They like fire hose kind of trickle.
Exactly.
With big money.
Yep.
So it looks like the House has passed the quote-unquote doc fix. Explain it.
This is the doc fix. This is an annual move that needs to be put forward in order to assure that doctors who provide Medicare are paid adequately. What we were facing was by April 1st, there was going to be a situation where Doctors who provided medical services were going to have a 24% pay cut. This is something that was, sort of been around for about 17 years now, which has, required Congress to go back from time to time to fix it. That has been changed in the House. Harry Reid has said that he is open to, passing this, primarily for the idea that, patients who receive Medicare funds and need their health care through Medicare, through doctors who accept Medicare, are going to be the ones who are hurt if this fails to move forward. But nevertheless, this is going to be a, pretty iffy battle.
Interesting. So the Republicans are okay giving more money to doctors, but not to unemployed workers. Okay. I'm not against the idea of paying doctors what they're worth and paying doctors a reasonable rate. Not at all. I don't think anybody is.
Correct. But that is sort of the obvious criticism that comes from that. But again, as I mentioned, the Democratic side for that in the Senate, at least, is there are a good number of Americans who rely on Medicare and Medicaid, and they are going to be losing their healthcare providers if this doesn't move forward, and if we have less doctors accepting Medicare patients. So there we go. That's the feel good, pat yourself on the back liberal argument for that.
There you go. Well, my grandmother. I mean, to be honest, it's we're talking about my grandmother in all of this. Because she, without Medicare, she'd be dead. I mean, that's the reality of things. They had savings. They had a little bit of a pension money set up, little savings, little Social Security. But with the health problems she's had the last 5 years, there's no way in hell she could have paid it out of her pocket. And there's no way she could have afforded private premiums. And there's no way she could have afforded private deductibles. She'd have been back. She'd been homeless, living, eating cat food, if you were to stay alive without Medicare.
No, that's very true, and thankfully your grandmother does. So I'm happy to hear that.
Yeah, I'm glad she isn't homeless, because then she'd have to come live with me. We've asked a number of times, but she just won't do it. She won't pull the trigger.
You can pay me to live with you. So
I'm not home often. I'm working like 16 hours a day.
I've seen your personal workspace when you do radio programs, and I'm not touching it.
You could see my personal workspace right now, perfectly clean.
Really?
I'm not quite sure what you're talking about.
That much?
What's that?
Okay, I apologize.
Brett, on the other hand, that's a whole other ball of wax.
Right. Okay.
No. Don't confuse the two of us.
I just presume he's like your roommate or something.
So. Okay. Now the next time I see you, I kill you.
I was going to say I thought it was your wife, but then I knew that I was just asking for trouble.
That's it. It's over. You're done. You're a done man. Let's finish this up. Chris Christie, the bridge, has it harmed him, helped him? How's Bridgegate affecting 2016?
Well, he said yesterday on his monthly program, Ask the Governor, that posted on a local New Jersey radio program, that it has not, in fact, affected his thought process when it comes to 2016. He said he's going to be putting that off, however, until the very last minute, which may actually be pretty wise considering how he is not in the best political shape right now and may need additional time to move forward with that. Nevertheless, it does go to show that he is trying to maintain himself as a 2016 frontrunner. And that's going to be something that we're going to be watching pretty closely.
Well, he had better hurry because I've been seeing several names popping up, and this Ben Carson guy, which I know very little about, evidently he's heavily into my neighborhood, handing out stickers to Tea Party to my Tea Twizzler friends who are just plastering Carson 2016 all over the place.
Not exactly. He's a brain surgeon at. I want to say Harvard. I can't say for sure, but he has been more than willing to wander into the realm of politics, and really came to notoriety for a speech that he gave alongside the president during the National Prayer Breakfast. That was one that I was on hand to witness during tool duty. That seemed to absolutely last forever, and he certainly has captured a lot of attention. Not the least of which is because he is a black conservative in a traditionally white field, as we all know.
Yeah, well, no, I'm all in favor of brain surgeons doing brain surgery. I just don't think they can do politics real well or other stuff. So let them do brain surgery. I don't really want to lose a good brain surgeon.
That's very true. But, you know, it feels like, you know, jokes would sort of write themselves. Like, you know, being able to lobotomize the, little opposition or whatnot. I don't know. You take that and you run it, but I'm tired.
There you go. Justin, always great talking with you. I appreciate you taking time for us.
Thanks. Much, Rick. You're the best.
Justin Duckham, Talk Radio News Service. And I'm not going to kill him, just for the record. Maybe a beating, like the nuns. Quick break. Right back. Stick around.
Radio of, for, and by We the Working People. The Rick Smith Show.
The steel strike of 1919 was called the Hunky Strike because most of the workers were either first or second generation immigrants from Eastern and Central Europe. Up until the end of World War I, workers had benefited from shorter hours, better pay, and the promise of union recognition. Once the war came to an end, the mill owners pursued anti-union open shop policies and other cost-cutting measures. There was near total suppression of all civil liberties. Major work issues included the 12-hour day, the 7-day work week, scores of workers being injured and maimed, union recognition, and poverty wages. Mary Harris, better known as Mother Jones, fought tirelessly throughout her life for social justice and human rights as a labor leader and a worker advocate. On August 20th, while visiting striking miners in Homestead, Pennsylvania, home of U.S. Steel's famous Homestead Steelworks, she defied injunctions against public gatherings and addressed 5,000 striking workers and their families. This speech led to her being arrested and jailed for giving an unauthorized speech. When brought before the judge, she was asked who had signed a permit to speak at a public gathering. She answered, Patrick Henry, Thomas Jefferson, and John Adams. As the strike went on, Mother Jones, the grandmother of all agitators, gave many speeches to rally the workers. One speech in Chicago was described by a spy for the U.S. War Department's Military Intelligence Division as the foulest and most profane that can be imagined, teeming with ultra-radical suggestions. Welcoming the spies, she would invite them to the front of the crowd so they could report her words accurately. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
But you can't stop the sounds of the drone. Lock up the jet, that's a wreck. So I can't raise my fist.
You can kill the protesters.
Can't kill.
You can kill the protesters.
You can't murder the rebel.
Murder.
You can't murder the Wisconsin.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. If you miss any portion of the program, you can download the podcast there at the website. Stitcher on the smartphone, all of that stuff right there for your entertainment, your enjoyment. You can also go to the website and watch the video of me flailing my arms around here in the studio. I've gotten some interesting comments back on that. People seem to enjoy my University of Toledo sweatshirt that I picked up on the wonderful weekend with my daughter, the getaway for the women's NCAA tournament. And, you know, it's, again, I got home tonight, my daughter gives me this big hug. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Look, there's nothing better than that, really. There's just not. And these are those moments that, you know, I'll remember, that I'll take with me to the grave. And that's, you know, that's the really important stuff. I mean, a lot of this stuff we get hung up with and fighting these battles, but the real important stuff, right there in our families and in our homes and the next generation. And, you know, you think about what we're leaving them. And that's what's frustrating. And that's, you know, people go, well, why you do what you're doing? You know, you could make much more money doing something else. You could have much more time doing something else. And look, there are moments where I can go do something else. I can spend less time working. I can have less stress. But at the end of the day, it comes down to when John Aitken said there a couple minutes ago, when they look us in the eye, when my daughter gets to be my age and looks back and goes, why didn't you do something? Why didn't you stop this? Why didn't you do something? I want to be able to say, look, we did. We tried. We fought. And, you know, I guess that's the least that I can do. And, you know, as you look at the powers and the forces that are lining up and the huge moneyed interests, it can be overwhelming. You know, I look at some of these radical right-wingers who are on hundreds of stations spewing nonsense that literally are about as bright as a broken thimble. Yet they have massive megaphones because they're towing the company line. They're given their talking points and said, read them. Don't deviate. Don't think. Don't deviate. This is your script. Go to it. And I look at the entire Reagan political career as one of those scripted out things. Think of the two biggest disasters that came out of Ronald Reagan. Mr. Not a cough in a carton full, hawking, I think it was either Pall Mall or Camel. It was one of the two brands, and I don't remember which. He had his doctor coat on. You can look it up online. There are tons of pictures of him being, you know, Dr. Ron, not a cough in a carton load. It's good for you. I got my doctor coat on. Cures the cough. It's good for you. That smoking thing, good for you. And we find out that they knew from the beginning what they were doing was killing us. If they could con you young enough, got you hooked when you were a teenager, because, hey, now, James Dean, man, everyone wants to be cool. I remember when I was in school, you know, the cool kids smoke, man. Don't you know that? And I go, I'd rather be one of the breathing kids. Thank you very much. And then Ronald Reagan became president. And the first thing that he did, one of the first things he did, in a very symbolic nature, was to tear the solar panels off of the White House. Jimmy Carter had installed one of the first generations of solar panels on the White House. Was a very conservation-minded guy. Wore sweaters in the White House. Kept the White House, I think, at like 63 or something, all winter long. And I think like at 80 in the summertime. Open the windows? Really? In the White House? How dare he? Reagan said, no, tear those god-awful solar panels off. Give me good oil-burning heat. And that's what he did. And what's interesting to me is that those solar panels that they tore off the White House, actually still in use. I mean, you go and you think about this. You go, Carter put those in the late 70s. Still in use today. And I forget the name of the college up in the Northeast. Somewhere in Massachusetts, New Hampshire, somewhere up there. The college, and I could look it up, but I don't have time. Right now, a minute and a half to go. Some college up there, they're using those panels to heat the hot water in the kitchen. Still, to this very day. And Obama, for all of his talk about solar, we still don't have solar panels in the White House. Talk about symbolism. See, that's the important stuff. Reagan was a master at it. Fired those Patco workers. Gave big business the symbol. Go ahead. Go after your workers. Attack them. If you missed any portion of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com. Thanks for being here. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the Buddha's sway. Imperial.